Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking with Attorney Irwin Aronson about some of the fights that are definitely coming. We're going to be talking about that pretty much all night. Now that the Republicans control the state house, the state senate, and the governor's mansion, what is that going to mean for working people? And will Republicans have buyer's remorse? Most of the Republicans that I've talked to never thought of the consequences that we're going to be talking about tonight. In fact, some of the people I know who voted for Corbett are now, even before he's taken power, are now reconsidering. But here's the thing, too late. Reconsidering too late. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Also, the Reverend Payton and Reverend Payton's Big Damn Band are going to be here talking about their gig tomorrow night at the Appalachian Brewing Company. And politics and some things that he may have seen in his travels. So that should be interesting conversations. Not often you find working class bands traveling the circuit. So whenever one comes to town, you need to grab hold of them and support them. Also, I want to thank Steve Herzenberg for sitting in for me on Sunday. And of course, our good friend Bob Kincaid over at the Horn for sitting in for me last night. I had a little weekend away. A much needed, recharge the batteries, rejuvenate, do all that stuff, get for the fights that are most certainly coming. And I do believe they're going to come fast, furious, early and often. And we've got to start organizing now, because when this attack starts, this full frontal attack, when it starts, there will be no let up. That's why we've got to start organizing. I had a great weekend away. It's one of those things, you know, you need every once in a while, Jake. You need to take a break and rev up the engine a little bit. And, you know, as I said last week, you know, I got to see if my wife can still stand me. And
what was the verdict?
Evidently, she can still stand me, which is a good thing. So
your clothes weren't out in the laundry.
No, actually, they weren't. We had a great 3 days away, which you need. You know, every couple needs a little time. To become, you know, like my wife put it, we can be Rick and Carol now instead of mom and dad, which is important for any relationship. It's important to, you know, to reconnect, because I know a lot of couples, once they assume those mom and dad roles, that's where they stay, and they have a hard time being around each other for a day. I've got some friends, boy, like you know, strike a match. Anyway, but it was a great time away. And we enjoyed the place we went, because we've been going to this place for got to be 12 years now. But some disturbing things, observations I made while there. And we love going away to the resorts up there in the Poconos and had a great time. But I don't want to sound like I'm being like some old codger, a curmudgeon, as you would put it. But, you know, to me, the place used to have some formality. And now you see the people showing up in, you know, like me in jeans and T-shirts. You know, and one of the things that really got me this time, every time we've gone, you go to dinner and there's a big table of eight or a big table of 10. You want me to get that for you? All right. You're, go ahead, take it. We'll wait. But a big table of 8 or 10 people, and you'd sit around at dinner time and you'd talk, you know, where are you from? Hey, what do you, you know, how long have you been married? All that stuff. And it's kind of a communal thing. It was kind of, you know, people coming together and being able to have a conversation. Well, they've done away with that. Everything there now is single tables where you interact with no one. And it's one of those things that, you know, as I was sitting there going, this is kind of dumb. It's indicative of our society. Everything very sterile, everything very isolated. And that's kind of the way it was. Everything was pretty isolated there. And I think as a society, we've lost that community. We've lost that ability to have a all right? You've lost that ability just to have a conversation. And I think there's something wrong with that. The other part of it is I think we've lost some civility. You know, some of the folks there, you would think the end of the world was coming because their basket of biscuits didn't show up to their table on time. And this is the kind of place where you go to kind of relax. And if this is relaxed for these folks, I'd hate to see how they are in real life. I mean, it's one of those things where you look and you go, there are some definite structural problems in the country, just on how we talk to each other and how we interact. There seems to be very little patience, very little civility. And I hope that at some point we can, as part of this program, begin to do some things to have conversations, to not want to reach across the table and strangle each other. You know what I mean, Jake? You run into that?
Occasionally.
Yeah, like right now. but, you know, the other part of it was I ran into a bunch of people who were human billboards. And the NASCAR coats and the, you know, all the human billboards, I'm calling them.
You know, I've worked with people like that.
And I'm amazed at how simple that is. And I'm going, how do I get people to do that? How do I get human billboards on my side? But yeah, it was interesting. And unfortunately, I think the Poconos have lost their, a portion of their mystique because it used to be a family place, where people went, you know, for family activities. And we had a great time and we spent quality time together. I came away this time going, you know, there's something missing. And it's that community. It's that just something simple. Just something simple. Anyway, today on the program, we're going to be talking with Irwin Aronson and also the Reverend, the good Reverend. Also, you know, over the weekend, I took a call from a guy who was, you know, who's telling me, oh, you know, hey, you're being elitist. I was called an elitist this weekend.
I understand. I was told.
I love that. I'm an elitist. I've been called a lot of
things. Did you find out where he was from, by the way?
No, he wouldn't say. You know, and I was hoping that he would call back after I said, wow, I've never been called an elitist before. I've been called a lot of things. A lot of things. But not an elitist. And it's because, look, I'm looking into the future. And I'm seeing some very real problems. I'm seeing the Republicans in this state doing what the Democrats probably should have done when they controlled Congress and the White House. Passed their vision, passed their bills, and stopped with the reaching out. Because I'm telling you, here in Harrisburg, there's not going to be much reaching out. There's not going to be much, oh, by the way, what do you think, Mr. Democrat? There's going to be none of that. We're going to see the state stores privatized, I think. I think that's really going to happen.
I mean, let's be honest, Rick. The only time that happens is when both sides have to compromise because neither side has complete control. And perhaps that's what the founding fathers envisioned, where both sides have to come together in common ground, and that's where you get good legislation. But you're right. There is no compromise with the numbers we're looking at in Pennsylvania. Absolutely none.
You know, the corporatocracy has taken over. The corporations have taken over. And you see now Corbett's inaugural people are big corporate lobbyists. Big surprise there. And, man, I got to tell you, as I'm looking into the future and the issues, I've been just compiling some issues going, what do we have? What fronts do we have to fight on? What are the big issues coming? And, there are pages of stuff that I fear they're going to go after. And I don't know that we're going to have enough time to organize over every issue because we have done such a bad job on November 2nd. It's one of those things.
I'm afraid the Republicans in this state will make the same mistake I think the Republicans in Washington will make, that this is a huge mandate and we can do whatever we want to do. I don't think that was the message. I know that wasn't the message.
Well, it wasn't the message, but it's what's going to happen. And in 2 years, are you going to be able to go back and undo all the damage that was done in these 2 years? And I don't think so. They think that this is an absolute mandate to privatize every form of our government, to slash every program down to the bone, to cut government workers, to cut government programs, just to slash and burn. And where does that then leave us? I mean, it's going to be an interesting experiment nonetheless. But the question is, how many people get harmed in the process?
The sad part about it is some of those things we will never be able to undo. And one of them is the state stores. If you privatize,
to me, that's just an absolute. Just probably one of the dumbest things you can. I should say not dumb. I should say short-sighted. Because I can give you I can give you 10 reasons why it's a bad idea. There's only one good reason, and it's not even really a good reason to privatize it. And that's we can get a quick infusion of cash. But once you've spent that quick infusion of cash, then what are you left with? You're left with where I grew up, in Cleveland, where, you could walk into a 7-Eleven and pick up a bottle of 42-proof vodka right there on the impulse aisle. We're now making alcohol an impulse item. Oh, hey, I need my Tic Tacs. Oh, yeah, a fifth of vodka, sure. I guess you got to be careful what you wish for. And some of my Republican friends did wish for this without thinking of where it's going to leave. Some of my Republican union friends who voted for Corbett and voted for the Republicans across the board, then you go back to them and say, well, you just voted to make Pennsylvania a right-to-work state. No, I didn't. I voted for Tom Corbett and the Republicans. Yeah, and? Oh, bang it. Too late now.
Don't you think if the man who's running with Corbett, Lieutenant Governor, makes a public announcement that perhaps the time has come to make Pennsylvania a right-to-work state, that maybe, just maybe, that might be in their thoughts, in their mindset, do you think?
And what bothers me, what just infuriates me, is Honorado ran such a poor campaign, did almost nothing to differentiate himself, did nothing to talk about those issues, did nothing to energize people to vote for him. And I liked the guy. He seemed like a decent guy to me.
Very personable.
But at the end of it, he did nothing to really set himself apart. When you're the underdog, when you're the guy chasing, you've got to come out and say, look, this is why me and not him. This is why me. Instead of saying, oh, yeah, well, I agree with that, too. Oh, yeah, that, too.
Well, occasionally he would talk about the non-taxation of Marcellus Shale, but he should have been.
That didn't catch.
But he should have went into the fine points of that. That, we're kicking the can down the road. We're actually going to increase taxes at a local level. And I would have also gotten into the point of job creation. I mean, Corbett's saying nothing about those jobs that we're going to create. He's saying nothing about who should man those jobs. I would have nailed him on every speech. He doesn't want to tax them. He hasn't ensured in any way, shape, or form or promised that the jobs created in Marcellus Shale would be manned by Pennsylvanians. I have not one time did he say that, because that was deliberate.
It's not his position.
That's exactly what the industry wants. They want to do what they want to do.
And he is the industry man. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Federal mine officials want to shut down a Massey-owned Kentucky mine for thousands of safety violations. MHSA Administrator Joe Main says the Freedom Energy Mine has repeatedly shown it can't be trusted to follow basic safety rules, and if it's not shut down, someone may be seriously injured or die. Congress has yet to pass a bill improving mine safety. United Mine Workers of America President Cecil Roberts says if right-wing groups like the Tea Party continue to successfully harness some working-class anger at the polls, workers will suffer on a range of issues, including mine safety regulations, which Republicans continually try to block. Roberts says in this 75th anniversary year of the CIO, it's useful to remember where worker advancements over the years have come from.
It was a labor movement and a Democratic Party that gave us Social Security, that gave us Medicare, gave us a right to organize, gave us unemployment insurance, gave us the right to go on vacation, gave us a right to send our kids off to college like everyone else. It was the labor movement and the Democratic Party working in conjunction together that did those things. It was not the Republican Party and certainly was not some far-right organization like the Tea Party.
How many workers have become discouraged and given up hope? According to a new report in USA Today, that number is 1.2 million. 1.2 million unemployed workers have become so distraught in the inability to find a new job, they've removed themselves from the workforce altogether. According to employment data, there are only enough jobs available for one out of every five unemployed workers. Hyatt Hotel workers have filed the first-of-its-kind multi-city injury complaint with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Jesse Russell reports.
The complaint covers 12 Hyatt properties in eight cities. The filing was triggered in part by a study in the American Journal of Industrial Medicine that revealed Hyatt housekeepers as having the highest injury rate in the country. Allegedly, the chain has raised the room quota and in some cases doubled the industry standard for number of rooms to be cleaned. The complaint has recommendations for OSHA on ways to make the workload easier for housekeepers and reduce the risks of injury. Some recommendations include caps on daily room quotas, longer handles for mops, fitted sheets to reduce the number of times housekeepers must lift heavy mattresses, and others. The complaints were filed by workers in San Antonio, San Francisco, Chicago, Santa Clara, Los Angeles, Long Beach, Honolulu, and Indianapolis.
The National Labor Relations Board is accusing American Medical Response of illegally firing a union worker after she criticized her boss on Facebook. The Connecticut company fired Don Marie Souza in December of 2009. The National Labor Relations Act prohibits employers from punishing workers for discussing working conditions and unionization, and the NLRB says that includes postings on Facebook. Non-union as well as union workers have the right to discuss working conditions without being punished by employers. Souza did her Facebook posts while on her own time. A hearing on the case is set for January. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope we can... we can organize, we can come together, we can fight back, because the fiscal responsible people, the so-called fiscally responsible Republicans, have finally, it's been a long time, they've been saying, we're going to get that waste, fraud, and abuse, we're going to find it, trust us, it's in the trunk with the welfare queen and the guy who lost his farm because of the estate tax, and you know, and those people, we know where it is, it's north, east, west, south of Baghdad, we know. We know it's there. Trust us. Trust us. Well, Kevin McCarthy, Republican from California, he was on PBS's NewsHour. He claims he's got a path to a balanced budget. Yet his cuts amount to less than one half of 1% of the budget. But it's interesting what they are, what he's chosen. $120 million, 0.003% of the budget. They're going to cut subsidies to Amtrak sleeper cars because, you know, having those sleeper cars on that train and subsidizing, helping that industry, bad idea. So 0.003% of the budget we're going to save. That was a good start. Then we're going to cut taxpayer subsidized union activities. Didn't say what they are, but claims it's $120 million, another 0.003%. We're going to stop all economic aid to foreign nations, 0.2%. $7.9 billion, he claims, which half of it goes to Afghanistan, which presumably I wouldn't think Republicans would want to cut. Do you? Because after all, we're going to be in Afghanistan a very, very long time because the withdrawal point has now been withdrawn to 2014. The other thing he wants to cut, 0.23% of the budget, child nutrition programs. More than 9% of the nutrition funding in the state in the budget is mandatory, which McCarthy has said he won't cut. And of the $8 billion in discretionary nutrition spending, the vast majority is to fund the supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children, otherwise known as WIC. So, as I've been saying all along, folks, they're going to balance their budgets on the backs of women, orphan, and children, on those least able to defend themselves, on those least able to fight back. And House Republicans have also targeted another grand program. Representative Tom Price of Georgia, he's the chairman of the Republican Study Committee. Kind of makes that sound official, doesn't it? A study committee. I wonder what they study. Because what they're proposing, they cut. They want to take an axe to this $25 billion in wasted spending, you know, creating jobs for those low-paid workers, you know, creating jobs in 37 states, about 250,000 jobs, you know, for low-income and unemployed workers, you know, that wasteful $25 billion. Problem is, it's already been cut. It's already gone. So what are you going to cut, Tom? Again, nothing. Nothing, no plan, no vision, no freaking ideas. Nothing at all. And as the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities pointed out, Price's characterizations that the fund is completely inaccurate, that it's funded. It's not. It's gone. And what's interesting is the people who've supported it, a Republican by the name of Haley Barbour, said it was a much-needed program, much needed aid during the recession, enabled businesses to hire new workers. But according to them, no, can't have that. Can't have that at all. So what's going to happen this January when Republicans take over? The New York Times did an interesting piece. Now in power, GOP vows cuts in state budgets. Republicans who have taken over state capitals across the country are promising to respond to crippling budget deficits with an array of cuts, among them proposals to reduce public workers' benefits in Wisconsin, scale back social services in Maine, and sell off state liquor stores in Pennsylvania, endangering the jobs of thousands of state workers. Now, on Saturday, I said during our weekend program, if you work for the state, get ready for a full-on frontal assault. They're coming after you. If you didn't vote in this last election, or if you voted for them, you are going to deserve everything that you get. And it's going to be massive. The article goes on to say states face huge deficits even after several years of grueling budgets, just as billions of dollars in stimulus money is drying up from Washington. With some of these new Republican state leaders having taken the possibility of tax increases off the table in their campaigns, deep cuts in state spending will be needed. You look at here in Pennsylvania, you know, Corbett has said no tax increases, never, ever, not going to do it. You got the guy in Mitch Daniels and the Republican majority there, the supermajority in the Senate, they're saying, you know what, not going to do it. We're going to tighten our belts and live within our means. That's a great right-wing mean, isn't it? We're going to tighten our belts. We're going to do like Ma Bell does there and tighten her belt at the kitchen table. And there's part of me, I got to be honest, there's part of me that hopes they do follow through on it. Because as I've always said, we've got to have some pain to get people marching in the streets, to get people standing up for themselves. That seems to be the only way we're going to wake up. The article goes on to say all sorts of candidates make all sorts of promises along the campaign trail, but there is a difference after last week's election. In many states, Republicans have gained such control that when they take office in the coming months, they will have a much easier time carrying out whatever agenda they choose. And again, as I've said, get ready to feel the pain, because Republicans are going to do what I said Democrats should have done. Propose the bill, pass the bill, sign the bill. Next. Propose the bill, pass the bill, sign the bill. Next. That's what's going to be happening.
If I can make a quick comment, you touched on something, Rick. It's something that we haven't talked about. This election had kind of a secondary benefit to the Republican Party. The numbers I saw, they took over the legislative process in twice as many states as Democrats. And what does that mean? What's coming up? Reapportionment, which means it's a huge advantage, which has an impact far into the future. So for the Republicans, it was a win-win-win. That does not bode well for working people in general.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Republicans have gained more than 690 seats in state legislatures across the country, leaving them with numbers last seen more than 80 years ago. What's going on? And the right-wing corporate-controlled for-profit media has done a masterful job in convincing us that President Obama isn't a citizen. Oh, he's a Muslim. No, wait a minute. He doesn't have a birth certificate. Oh, no, wait a minute. He's a socialist. No, wait, he's a communist. No, he's a fascist. No, he's a Mormonist. A what? Mormonist. I mean, they can't make things up fast enough and put ist and ism behind it fast enough to scare people. And the Democrats did a crummy job of getting out there and saying, you know what, this is what we're doing. And what's really infuriating to me is this economy is going to turn around. Slowly, it's going to continue to slowly turn around. Because, look, big business is not going to dump all this money, although I think they should. The Republicans ran on it. They ran on once you know, business feels safe, once they feel secure, they're gonna hire and hire. And in 6 months, I'm predicting 6 months, the recession should be over. Full employment for everybody who wants a job. Just call Tom Corbett's office. He evidently knows where the jobs are. But isn't that what they ran on? That the whole reason that jobs aren't being created is because, well, there's a mandate for health care. What? We want people to be responsible for themselves? How dare we? And I've yet to have anybody, and you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com, or call us here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you've got a grand idea of how this is going to turn out, because I've yet to find one piece of legislation that a Republican has proposed that has benefited me or any other working person. In my lifetime, I've yet to find one. And for, you know, we're in our sixth year, going on 6 years on the air, I've yet to have one person say, Rick, this is the bill, H.R. 1437, passed by the Senate, signed by this president, that benefited the working people of this country. I've had some people try and say, well, you know, they passed that Family Medical Leave Act. Yeah. It was a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president. You could argue that Clinton was almost a Republican, but in name, he was still a Democrat. And it was watered down to the point to where it was useless for the majority of the people who could actually use it because there's no pay in it. There's 12 weeks of unpaid leave. How many people in this country can afford 12 weeks of unpaid anything? Not many.
And they've really watered it down under certain circumstances. It mandates that you have to take vacations first. It's really watered down. And as you said, non-compensated, whereas you go in a lot of industrialized countries, especially in Europe, they not only have a stronger bill, but you get paid for taking it.
But we're going to see some interesting times. And as I said before the election, if everything went south the way it did and Democrats took their beating like it did, sitting in this chair, interesting times. Lots to talk about, lots to point at, lots to look at. And we are going to be here to do just that. We're going to be here to make sure that you know exactly what they're doing to you. Because I think it's important that you know exactly what they are doing to you. Every step of the way. Whether it's privatizing the liquor stores, whether it's making Pennsylvania a right-to-work state, whether it's doing away with Davis-Bacon, whether it's any number of things, you need to know who did it and why. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with Erin Aronson.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Our society, like most others, glorifies war. For God and country is the cry. Be all you can be is the manly challenge. Bring 'em on was George W.'s machismo war whoop, which drew cheers from barstool soldiers like he had been. Of course, war must be glorified to make it possible. How else can presidents and generals lure sane young men and women into the voracious maw of deathly chaos and unimaginable horror? As General William T. Sherman put it in 1880, young men think that war is all glamour and glory, but let me tell you, boys, it is all hell. For a glimpse of this hell, check out an October 30th Washington Post article titled Operation Damage Control at WashingtonPost.com. It's meant to be a positive piece, extolling the wondrous ability of U.S. trauma teams in Afghanistan to save grievously injured soldiers. But the article also lifts the covers on the raw carnage that is the true story of war, highlighting 9 soldiers injured in a single week. 2 of them lost a leg. 2 others lost a leg and a foot. 2 lost both legs. 2 lost both legs and a hand. 1 was paralyzed from the waist down. 3 also lost their genitals. Lost is a euphemism for blown apart. But as the Post points out, bombs not only shred limbs, quote, they drive dirt deep into flesh and often peel skin back a foot or more above the bone's jagged end. It takes multiple surgeries over several weeks just to find all the damage. Blood clots, pneumonia, collapsed lungs, and other complications often follow, all deadly. Not to mention the brain damage, pain, and psychological trauma. This is Jim Hightower saying, so far some 8,000 soldiers have been injured in Afghanistan. And for what? Ask them about the glory of war.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
I don't know if you've seen this new emblem, this new symbol for Tom Corbett. You know, for 1984 fans, wow, Goldsmith is watching. It's this eye kind of thing with the Capitol dome and, really, really creepy. Really kind of scary on a number of levels given, Tom Corbett's past with the Twitter folks. But look, yeah, that's, I think, the least of our worries right there. The rest of it is what they're going to do to the budget, what they're going to do to folks who can't defend themselves. That's why I've got Erwin Aronson on the phone, our good friend. Erwin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm good, but, worried.
Well, it's the right place to be. We're all a little bit worried or wary or any number of kinds of things as we sit by with bated breath awaiting to hear how a $5 billion hole is going to be filled without increasing taxes and without doing violence to the people of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
And, you know, I talked to some Republican friends this past weekend who, you know, they voted for Tom Corbett. They voted for their Republican legislator. And when I started telling them what's coming, they all said I was lying, for one. And then when they realized that I wasn't, they realized very quickly that they had made a serious mistake.
Well, I don't know if anybody can say whether or not they've made a mistake until we see what this hidden agenda is. One of the problems in this campaign was that a lot was said about what was not going to happen, but nothing was said about what would happen. And now we've had an election, the people have spoken, and it is up to Governor-elect Corbett to tell us what it is he's going to do to fill the hole.
Given the majorities that the Republicans have, is there anything that the Democrats can do to slow the process down? Is there anything that we can do? Let's say they want to privatize the liquor stores. Is there anything we can do to stop them?
Well, first of all, I think people need to step back, catch their breath, and understand that when the numbers are like this, it's not about Democrats and Republicans exactly. It is about members of the Senate and members of the House who represent people versus those who represent big business corporate entities and the know-nothings or some combination of them. Hopefully, there will be a coalition of thinking Democrats and Republicans in the Senate and in the House who collectively can stand up to insanity and come up with an alternative. We spoke last week, for example, about the liquor stores. How someone can determine to just cast aside a very successful business that brings hundreds of millions of dollars into the state treasury every year to get a one-time quick fix shot is beyond me. But as is always the case, I am a dreamer, and I'm hoping for the best, planning for the worst, but hoping for the best. So we'll see. And it's not just the liquor stores. We need to deal with some of the fundamental reality of what makes Pennsylvania tick, the net, the floor that makes Pennsylvania exist, whether it's Medicaid for people who need access to health care and don't have it, or it is funding for educating our children, the most precious resource that this or any society can have, whether it is programs for autistic children, whether it is programs for the intellectually challenged, the mentally disabled, the multiplicity of programs that have over the period since 1980 and the Reagan presidency been delegated from the federal government to the states, and which the states, like Pennsylvania, have traditionally funded. We now face that challenge. Are we going to be Chris Christie's New Jersey, aimed at slashing and burning and fueling resentment toward people who provide critical services to our communities? Or will we be the keystone of the country, as Pennsylvania has always to this point been? And it's up to, ultimately, the new Corbett administration to tell us what their proposals are. They set the agenda. And the rest of us will respond to that, and we will be looking to build that brand coalition that is not Democrat, not Republican, not liberal, not conservative, not right-wing, not left-wing, but pro-Pennsylvania.
That's an excellent way of putting that. And, you know, I noticed that Speaker McCaul has requested that everyone come back to vote on Monday the 15th. My thought, what can possibly get done in that session?
Well, they're talking about only a one-day voting session, as I understand it, although they'll be in session for a couple of days. Certainly, there are several pieces of legislation that are on the House calendar awaiting action that have been passed by the Senate that can do some real good for the people of Pennsylvania. One, of course, is legislation to deal with the looming crisis for public employee pensions, both the state employees retirement system and the public school employees retirement system, passed by the Senate, awaiting action by the House. And when the House earlier this week and late last week suggested they weren't going to come back, everybody who watches these kinds of issues was just stumped. But it was really pleasing and good news to hear that Speaker McCaul, retiring Speaker McCaul, future former Majority Leader Todd Egis, have decided to bring the House back. Pension reform is certainly one of those issues that's there. There are any number of others that are awaiting action, and
from a conversation I had with people in the know earlier this evening and one that late this afternoon. There is an effort going on as we speak to determine what issues can be taken up in this one-day session that will not be of such controversy that they will lapse into lengthy debate just in an effort to have people talk one another out and in the process of so doing, run the clock out. So we shall see. There's legislation to protect firefighters in Pennsylvania that is pending. There's a House resolution that would recognize the efficacy and vitality and virtue of project labor agreements that is on the House calendar. There are several other bills that are awaiting attention and action, and hopefully the House will have the opportunity to deal with several of them.
Because, you know, and looking at the pension issue, the longer we wait on this, the longer we wait to do anything on it, the worse I think the problem probably gets.
No question about it. The there is, in 2012, a huge funding crisis that will be there and on the table in every one of the 500 school districts in Pennsylvania. There is a separate crisis that exists and is looming in the same time frame for the state employees retirement system. And all of this, of course, is based upon the fact that the legislature for years has failed to provide the funding on their side of the equation, and they have failed to require the school districts to provide the funding on their side of the equation to pay for the benefits that are promised, even though state employees and public school employees have had deducted from each of their paychecks the contribution that they were supposed to make to fund their pensions. And the result is now that instead of facing the music and paying the bill that they created, they've attempted to deal with a combination of things that run from kick the can to penalize the very people who have paid the bill and penalize the people who have given up so much else in order to make sure that they had a secure retirement when it arrived.
And the part that bothers me and what I see probably being part of the end game is to penalize future employees by giving them less benefits and creating a divided workforce.
Well, penalizing people who have yet to be hired is bad enough and really repugnant. But when we do one other thing, and that's to have two people working side by side doing essentially the same work in the employ of the same employer who know inevitably that at the end of the day, despite doing the same thing, bringing the same skill level, their treatment as well as their pay will be different and their retirement will be different from one another, really breeds workforce contempt at a time when we need to be building morale.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, one of the things that bothers me and that I worry about is that, you know, given the fight and given the fact that we're making these jobs, well, like the private sector with poor benefits and poor pay, and I don't think you're going to get the quality people that these positions, that are necessary for these positions.
Well, first of all, let's deal with reality. Making these things like the private sector is a misnomer. One of the great lies of this election cycle and of so many others is this lie about public employees somehow being overpaid or being paid something that they couldn't earn in the private sector. There aren't any public employees who are making $300, $500, $800, $1 million a year and getting breathtaking bonuses and all manner of perks and who knows what. That's what happens in the private sector. That's not what happens in the public sector. In the public sector, we have a group of dedicated people who give of themselves and give their all day in and day out to make sure that those things that we can't do for ourselves get done and get done on time, get done on budget, and get done very well. They're the people that make sure our kids get back and forth to school every day. They're the people that put out the fires. They're the people that protect our streets. They're the people that drive our kids back and forth to school on the bus and feed them in the school cafeterias and teach them how to read and how to write and how to do arithmetic equations. These are the people who do those things that society requires of them. And we somehow or another are asked by politicians, left and right, Democrat and Republican, to somehow resent them for the wonderful work that they do. So this is just a silly game to suggest that somehow or another people, because they're employed by a public employer versus a private employer, are loafers or lazy or bums. These are the greatest people on the planet, and I'm proud that my children, when they went to school, they're a little bit old for that now, went to school every day on a school bus driven by a union member who happened to be a public employee, for example, and went to schools where the teachers didn't have to look over their shoulder to figure out whether or not there was going to be a meal on the table tonight and worry about that when they were trying to teach my children how to read and how to navigate through a complicated society. On the other hand, all that having been said, for people in public life at the elected level to scorn public employees and to use them as pawns in a race to the bottom or in a wholesale devaluation of our society and our community that is predicated on privatizing the very things on which we depend that should be provided by our tax dollars is just fundamentally wrong. And it's not a Democratic idea. It's not a Republican idea. It's just a bad idea.
I absolutely agree, Irwin. Always great talking with you. Always gives me something to think about.
I hope I give not only you, but more importantly, our listeners something to think about, because in the last analysis, Rick, just because the talking heads on Fox News have something to say doesn't make it true. And we need to be able to talk about the truth, which is the reason that your show is so valuable to us and to our community. And it's such a pleasure always to be on, because we get to talk a little bit about the truth.
I appreciate the time, and I look forward to talking to you again next Wednesday.
Take care, my friend. Be well. Be safe. Give that guy, Jake, a shot in the ribs for me, okay?
Don't tempt me.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Irwin.
Thanks, Bill.
In speaking about the public-private, when we come back, I'm going to talk about some private employees who, I got to tell you, I'm going to blow your mind when I tell you this stuff. Stick around. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call them at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody, everybody, just get into it. Get stupid, get it started, get it started, get it started. Let's get it started. Ha.
things that Irwin brought up that, you know, has been the fallacy out there for too long is that, well, the private sector has decided that, you know, 401ks are the best thing to have. And the private sector has decided that we don't need paid sick days. And the private sector has decided we don't need vacations. And private sector has decided we don't need unions. And all of this stuff that the quote-unquote private sector supposedly decided, when really it was the investor class. The very wealthy decided that they didn't want to have to give away any of that stuff. They didn't want to have to do that. And when you see the public sector workers who do get reasonable pensions, who do have a couple of days in case they get sick, and you know what? A vacation every now and again. Heaven forbid. And do make a reasonable wage. And study after study has shown that the public sector worker makes less than the private sector. Even though they have better education, more degrees, more training, because the benefits are a little bit better. You get health care. Healthcare, novel concept. You get a pension. What? Not a 401k? Well, the Daily Finance. It's a magazine, obviously, that talks about Daily Finance. Douglas McIntyre wrote the piece, Outrageous CEO Perks, This Year's Top Pick. And he writes, thanks to gross excesses in executive compensation exposed during the financial crisis, CEO pay has come under increased scrutiny in recent years. At the prodding of the SEC, compensation boards at public companies have cleaned up their act somewhat, but CEOs still typically make far more than their shareholders consider reasonable. Plus, they often negotiate themselves very lavish perks. Here are a couple of things that I thought were interesting that they picked out. Occidental Petroleum's shareholders enjoyed a 35% return this past year under Iraney's reign. As a result, Iraney, his compensation for this year, $31.4 million. That included a figure of $391,000 for someone to do his taxes and give him a little bit of financial planning. $391,000. The average person, people like you, Jake, people like me, the average person pays about $500 for financial planning. But our Mr. Millionaire here, $391,000. Over half of the shareholders of Occidental Petroleum, not happy, but got it anyway. Richard Anderson of Delta Airlines, you may have heard of Delta Airlines recently, did a nice job denying their workforce, their flight attendants of unionization. He may not make as much as all the other CEOs in the little CEO game club, but he got his corporate perks. In fact, his $2.25 million salary a year, he got a bunch of other stuff. That would be, I don't know, considered personal, you know, like the $772,000 to relocate from Minneapolis to Atlanta. Turns out, he bought a house for a whole bunch of money, took out a loan for a whole bunch of money, and when he went to sell the house, he was $772,000 short. So Delta Airlines, being the wonderful employer that they are, said, oh, Richard, Mr. CEO, don't you worry your pretty little head. We'll write out that check for $772,000 while we deny our flight attendants a voice on the job. Isn't that wonderful? Doesn't that make you feel warm all over to know that we've got a CEO class taken care of? Don't have to worry about him being foreclosed upon?
Isn't that pure capitalism?
It's wonderful. Carol Bartz, she joined Yahoo as the CEO in January of 2009. She received about $39 million in compensation for that year. That included equity she would have otherwise made at her last job, although estimates made by Glass Lewis, a leading governance consulting firm, said that Yahoo paid her more than she was worth, putting her on the top of its overpaid CEO list. But Bartz, you know, she said, you know what, I need to negotiate my contract. You know, that thing that we don't want workers to have, but we CEOs have to have. We all need contracts on the CEO class. Yahoo paid her lawyer, $110,000 to negotiate her contract. Thank you, ma'am. May I have another? That's like somebody kicking me in the behind and going, please, can you do it again? One more time for good old time's sake? I mean, you know, imagine if a union said, you know what? XYZ company, we're going to negotiate a contract and you're going to pay our lawyers. Do you want to hear the right wing lose its ever-loving freaking mind?
Mm.
Here's another beautiful one. Boston Scientific, their CEO, Ray Elliott, another fortunate guy making about $33.4 million a year. He got $1.3 million for relocating. So just for, you know, coming from one place to another, $1.3 million. I don't know about you, but I don't ever remember someone saying, you know, we want you to transfer. You know, when I transferred from Allentown to here, they moved my stuff, which was nice of them because it's part of my contract. And I got like $2,200 in living expenses. And that was supposed to cover my hotel until my stuff came. I don't remember $1.3 million. I'm feeling cheated. I'm telling you, I'm feeling cheated. And I'm asking you, how many of you folks out there, how many of you get these kind of perks? Because these are the people we voted for on November 2nd. These are the folks who are going to take over. Oracle CEO Larry Ellison, $84.5 million in 2009. Highest paid CEO in the country. But that wasn't enough for Larry. Lonesome Larry needed some protection. Lonesome Larry needed some company. So Oracle paid $1.4 million in security-related costs. Because, you know, out of that $84.5 million he makes a year, just couldn't afford a little security detail. Just couldn't do it. Mama needs a little extra cheese on her Whopper. And that costs. You're going to love this one. Randall L. Stevenson of AT&T, the country's 12th highest paid CEO. Yearly compensation, $20.3 million. As part of his pay, he gets, you're going to love this, $216,000 for country club memberships. Yep. Isn't that beautiful?
I'm assuming that means multiple.
Well, I would hope.
Wow.
Travelers J. Fisherman receives, wow, who gets $20.1 million a year. He gets $724,000 for a car and a driver. CEO of Abercrombie Fitch, whose company has just tanked, he gets $639 to use the aircraft. And Les Moonves of CBS, who's paid $44 million a year, he gets $2.2 million in tax reimbursements because he doesn't want to have to pay taxes. So you and I get to pay that for him. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, but it's better than that, Rick. A lot of these companies are public, and supposedly the board of directors are supposed to be the overseers. There's only one problem. It's a good old boys club.
Yep.
You know? They hire each other at nice little fat salaries and kind of go along with the CEO.
We're right back after this.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Federal mine officials want to shut down a Massey-owned Kentucky mine for thousands of safety violations. MHSA Administrator Joe Main says the Freedom Energy Mine has repeatedly shown it can't be trusted to follow basic safety rules, and if it's not shut down, someone may be seriously injured or die. Congress has yet to pass a bill improving mine safety. United Mine Workers of America President Cecil Roberts says if right-wing groups like the Tea Party continue to successfully harness some working-class anger at the polls, workers will suffer on a range of issues, including mine safety regulations, which Republicans continually try to block. Roberts says in the 75th anniversary year of the CIO, it's useful to remember where worker advancements over the years have come from.
It was a labor movement and a Democratic Party that gave us Social Security, gave us Medicare, gave us a right to organize, gave us unemployment insurance, gave us the right to go on vacation, gave us a right to send our kids off to college like everyone else. It was a labor movement and a Democratic Party working in conjunction together that did those things. It was not the Republican Party and certainly was not some far-right organization like the Tea Party.
How many workers have become discouraged and given up hope? According to a new report in USA Today, that number is 1.2 million. 1.2 million unemployed workers have become so distraught in the inability to find a new job, they've removed themselves from the workforce altogether. According to employment data, there are only enough jobs available for one out of every five unemployed workers. Hyatt Hotel workers have filed the first of its kind multi-city injury complaint with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Jesse Russell reports.
The complaint covers 12 Hyatt properties in 8 cities. The filing was triggered in part by a study in the American Journal of Industrial Medicine that revealed Hyatt housekeepers as having the highest injury rate in the country. Allegedly, the chain has raised the room quota and in some cases doubled the industry standard for number of rooms to be cleaned. The complaint has recommendations for OSHA on ways to make the workload easier for housekeepers and reduce the risks of injury. Some recommendations include caps on daily room quotas, longer handles for mops, fitted sheets to reduce the number of times housekeepers must lift heavy mattresses, and others. The complaints were filed by workers in San Antonio, San Francisco, Chicago, Santa Clara, Los Angeles, Long Beach, Honolulu, and Indianapolis.
The National Labor Relations Board is accusing American Medical Response of illegally firing a union worker after she criticized her boss on Facebook. The Connecticut company fired Don Marie Souza in December of 2009. The National Labor Relations Act prohibits employers from punishing workers for discussing working conditions and unionization, and the NLRB says that includes postings on Facebook. Non-union as well as union workers have the right to discuss working conditions without being punished by employers. Souza did her Facebook posts while on her own time. A hearing on the case is set for January. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the New Dark Ages.
Let's hope not. Mort Kondrak, he's a contributor over at Fox News, dismissed Michelle Bachmann's, my girlfriend's, campaign against Representative Jed Harnsling, a Republican of Texas, to win the seat of the House GOP conference chair. He said, quote, Bachmann is just a loudmouth. Every once in a while, she gets caught in some outrageous comment. Yeah, that's what I love about her. Crazy is good. I like crazy. I think it'd be entertaining to see Bachmann as the head of the RNC or the Republican committee there. I think it'd be great. Let's go to the phone lines. We got Mike on line one. How are we doing today, Mike?
Pretty good, Rick. Hey, I was listening to your discussion early on about Democratic candidates.
Yep.
We as labor have to reevaluate in view of this election, I think, how we do business. We have to vet candidates a lot better before we throw a lot of support and a lot of effort behind them.
I agree.
I believe that Dan Honorato's chances of being elected ended in the third debate in Philadelphia when he came out as a rabid anti-gunner. There are some things you can't do in Pennsylvania in politics, and that's one of them.
Yeah, do you think that was – I'm going to disagree. I think his chances were over before that.
Well, it may have been, but that definitely was a nail in the coffin.
Because as much as I like the guy personally, I've had a number of conversations with him personally. As much as he's a decent guy personally, he didn't differentiate himself in a, as you're pointing out, in a positive way. Had he come out and said, "Look, you know, I'm going to make sure that the state workers are going to get a fair shake. I'm going to make sure that the services that everyone depends on are going to be there." Had he done that, I think it's a different ballgame. Had he come out and said, look, the folks on the right want to privatize the liquor stores. They want to make Pennsylvania a right-to-work state. They want to do all of this Chamber of Commerce stuff that the Chamber, you got to give the Chamber credit. They've been pushing for a generation. And now we're going to see if it comes true.
Well, there's a lot of truth in that, but surely from the standpoint of labor, we have to vet these candidates a lot better. Same thing, we don't have the card check bill right now, in my mind, principally because of two people. One of them is our inspector, and the other one is Joe Lieberman. You know?
I agree.
And that's as close as we were going to get. And yet, the AFL-CIO, even after our inspector said, I'm not going to back card check, we backed him. What's that about? I mean, that should have been a phone call that says, you sure you want to say that? Because if you do, you get nothing from us. But you know how politics is done. But we have to stop doing that.
Yeah, but here's the question I then have, you know, and I agree with you on one level, because my gut tells me, you know what, we should have done with Altmaier. We should have taken Jason Altmaier out in the public square and gone Machiavellian on him. Gutted him in public square so everyone could see it happen. But then what do you end up with? You end up with someone who's much worse on 99% of the issues where you had Jason Altmaier, who one or two you disagreed with. I understand the rage. I understand the frustration. But, you know, are you then biting your nose off in spite of your face?
Well, sometimes you may have to do that. And it won't. I don't think that will be worse than what we got.
Yeah.
I mean, because you have to say, look, we have the smarts within the labor movement to accurately analyze the political landscape to know what you can and can't do. And as much as the Democratic Party is usually the friend of labor, sometimes they aren't. And they aren't when they take positions that make them unelectable. And as much as they may think it's the thing to do, when you recognize that the largest part of the electorate, especially the independent voters that we need to be over the top in a tight election, are against it, you can't do it. You got to give it up. You got to put that down as much as you want to play with that dangerous thing and say, no, we can't do this because we won't get elected, which is exactly what happened here.
Well, and is what I've been saying all along is what needs to happen is labor needs to start creating its own labor communications, like the Chamber of Commerce did. You know, I go back to the 52 election that the Wall Street Journal opined that they feared the labor press was going to throw the election away from Eisenhower, and because it was that powerful, labor had such a strong voice. And over the years, it's eroded, and it's been destroyed. They need to go back after and do what they did for years: organize person to person, year round, constantly talking to their members and to the general public.
100% agree, Rick. 100% agree that's what we need to do. We need to start planning for the next election now.
Absolutely.
And we need to have people in labor who are focusing on that now.
And I think they are.
I hope so.
From some of the conversations I've had with folks, I think they're seeing the writing on the wall that, look, you know, I get pigeonholed a lot that, oh, you're just a Democratic mouthpiece, and I'm not. There are a lot of things that Democrats do that just infuriate me. And I don't think of myself as purely a Democrat. I'm a labor guy. I'm a 21-year Teamster. That's what I think of myself as. I'm a working class guy. But as you pointed out earlier, the Democrats have historically been on our side. So that's where my support is gone. If you can find me a reasonable Republican who will support labor initiatives and support the right of collective bargaining, I'd be behind him.
And we have done that. We backed Mike Fisher in the first run against Rendell. Because Rendell came to us and said, I got nothing for you.
Yeah,
so we didn't back him.
And I got to be honest, Adorado would have been a hard sell had he won.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
But I think he would have been less bad than the guy we got now.
Well, you know, I agree with you. I think he would have been less bad. And what gets me, though, is that he took positions. That, you know, I got to be frank. The Democratic Party needs to understand that the gun control debate is over. That's settled law.
Yep.
You may not like it, but it's over. And when somebody stands up and says, I don't care what the Supreme Court and the law says, I'm going to do what I want to do, you're going to lose that election in Pennsylvania. You might do all right in Connecticut or Massachusetts, but you're going to lose the election in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, which, again, you know, I talk with my gun friends who I like to argue with, and I like to take the opposite position. But if you do believe, as I do, that the Constitution is a living, breathing document, it is decided law.
Yeah.
It may not, in my opinion and in my reading of the Federalist Papers and of history, it was never meant to be what it is today, I don't believe. I believe everybody was supposed to be in the militia. I believe everybody, like a community militia, we weren't supposed to have standing armies. I believe that was the intent. But as we've moved forward, the Constitution, in its mode of living and breathing, has decided. And we are where we are.
And that's what the Democratic Party has to do. They have to put this down and say to the few anti-gun radicals out there, we hear what you're saying, but it isn't reality anymore. This is over. This argument is over. It's been settled at the U.S. Supreme Court twice. It's over.
Well, let me ask you a last question, because I'm going to have to take a break here in a minute. But let me ask you, you know, if in talking about gun control laws, is there anything that you don't think we should have? I mean, are there any weapons that I shouldn't have, in your opinion?
Well, most of the weapons you shouldn't have, you can't buy, is the point.
Well, no, I have friends who believe they should be able to own a howitzer. They should be able to own anything they want. There should be no control. That's their belief.
Well, Rick, in fact, you can own a howitzer right now. It's legal to own a howitzer. I know. I have friends who own cannons.
Come to think of it, I know a guy who had one.
But you can't get the shells to fire them. That's what you can't get. So what you've got is a very expensive, heavy piece of pipe mounted on a trailer. That's it. That's what you got. Most weapons that you can't own, and those weapons, even today, most people don't know that there are hundreds of people, thousands of people in America who legally own machine guns. And yet you never hear of legally owned machine guns being used in crime. The point is that those laws will not forestall someone who has bent on mayhem with any weapon. If you watch the two guys in California that had the big shootout with the cops,
yeah.
Those were converted weapons, illegally converted. And, oh, by the way, a judge had those men and those weapons under his control and turned them loose prior to that event. So, you know, if the laws were going to stop it, yeah, I might even believe it. But I know it's not going to stop it. It's not going to happen, because people who will commit mayhem and commit murder don't hesitate to violate any gun law.
Excellent point, Mike. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Mike. You know, and we could, and it is. It's an excellent point, but yeah, we could talk this gun thing. I believe it's decided. It is what it is.
Well, I don't disagree with Mike on a certain level. I think it was an issue, but I think Honorado had more problems than just a gun issue.
Yeah, I thought he lost the election long before that comment, just because he wasn't able to get people out to vote for him. He didn't grab you. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now. Until the end.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Our society, like most others, glorifies war. For God and country is the cry. Be all you can be is the manly challenge. Bring 'em on was George W.'s machismo war whoop, which drew cheers from barstool soldiers like he had been. Of course, war must be glorified to make it possible. How else can presidents and generals lure sane young men and women into the voracious maw of deathly chaos and unimaginable horror? As General William T. Sherman put it in 1880, young men think that war is all glamour and glory, but let me tell you, boys, it is all hell. For a glimpse of this hell, check out an October 30th Washington Post article titled Operation Damage Control at WashingtonPost.com. It's meant to be a positive piece extolling the wondrous ability of U.S. trauma teams in Afghanistan to save grievously injured soldiers. But the article also lifts the covers on the raw carnage that is the true story of war, highlighting 9 soldiers injured in a single week. 2 of them lost a leg. 2 others lost a leg and a foot. 2 lost both legs. 2 lost both legs and a hand. 1 was paralyzed from the waist down. 3 also lost their genitals. Lost is a euphemism for blown apart. But as the Post points out, bombs not only shred limbs, quote, they drive dirt deep into flesh and often peel skin back a foot or more above the bone's jagged end. It takes multiple surgeries over several weeks just to find all the damage. Blood clots, pneumonia, collapsed lungs, and other complications often follow, all deadly. Not to mention the brain damage, pain, and psychological trauma. This is Jim Hightower saying, so far some 8,000 soldiers have been injured in Afghanistan. And for what? Ask them about the glory of war.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Thrilled that Pennsylvania has the first senator from Walmart, or the first senator from Wall Street, the first Wall Street approved senator. Our junior senator, Pat Toomey, Mr. Wall Street himself. Scary, scary stuff. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. That's the number if you want to get involved. Also, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You're going to love this story. Back at the end of October, I came across it and just didn't get around to it until now. Channel 4, I guess, out, Team 4 out in Pittsburgh. The headline reads, Debt Collectors Accused of Fake Courtroom. The story reads, a sign on the front of the building on West 39th Street tells visitors that it's the UniCredit Debt Resolution Center in Erie, I guess it is. Once debtors got inside, they were fooled into believing that they were in a courtroom with a judge. But the whole thing was fake, according to a lawsuit filed by the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office. Team 4's Jim Parson reported that UniCredit America is accused in the lawsuit of deceiving, misleading, and coercing hundreds of consumers into paying off their debts. Inside the building, a pair of locked oak doors with brass handles resembling a courtroom entrance. The company is accused in the lawsuit of building this mock courtroom, complete with a judge's bench and witness stand. The Attorney General's office told Team 4 that UniCredit lured debtors into the building by sending employers, you're going to love this, by sending employees who appeared to be sheriff's deputies to their homes, implying that they would be taken into custody if they failed to appear at the phony court hearings. Stop and think about this for a second. You got this credit collections agency, Jake, who's saying, well, we've got our fake cop in a fake uniform, going to take you down to this fake courthouse to try and trick people. And look, you know, there's a percentage of the population that, honestly and truthfully, they're not wise to these scams, especially when you're talking about elderly folks who they see a uniform and they freak out anyway. But this is the kind of stuff that corporate America pulls.
That's first of all, about 3 different laws they violated there. Impersonation of an officer, 1.
Did they? And this is part of what this, and I can't wait to find out. But part of this is, did they identify themselves as a sheriff, or did they just have a security outfit on? Having a security outfit on is not a crime.
I guess my question becomes then, the minutia, how did they introduce themselves?
I'm a representative from UniCredit, here to help collect on the debt you owe. Whether you, and I'm interested to see how this is going to go. I want to follow this. But if you go back to the congressional battle over the Wall Street reform, if you remember that, something that, again, I don't think went far enough. But remember that Chris Dodd, former senator from Connecticut, advanced a bill to create the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, something the Republicans were just ballistic about. He wanted to grant it the power to write and enforce rules governing payday lenders, debt collectors, and other financial companies that are not part of the banking world. And guess who was against it? Any guesses? Two choices. They're Democrats and they're Republicans. Guess who was against it? March 2009, Wall Street Journal. Senator Bob Corker, the Tennessee Republican, who is playing a crucial role in bipartisan negotiations over financial regulation, pressed to remove a provision from draft legislation that would have empowered federal authorities to crack down on payday lenders. People involved in the talk said the industry is politically influential in his home state of Tennessee and a significant contributor to his campaign record show. The Senate Banking Committee Chairman, Christopher J. Dodd, Democrat of Connecticut, proposed legislation in November that would give a new consumer protection agency the power to write and enforce rules governing payday lenders, debt collectors, other financial industries. Last month, Mr. Corker pressed Mr. Dodd to scale back substantially the power of that consumer protection agency, which would have over companies, according to the three people involved in the talks. Dodd went along, these people, according to these folks, in an effort to reach bipartisanship, another Democrat, weak-kneed, spineless, just so he could make a deal with Corker. After the talks broke down between Democrats and the Republicans' top guy there, Shelby. Then in May, what you had is you had Mitch McConnell, minority leader. He tried it again. And the president ripped the plan, saying it was worse than the status quo, with dangerous carve-outs for payday lenders, debt collectors, and other financial service operations. And again, I say, Wall Street wins. Because you've got these companies, these predatory companies out there who are pulling this kind of nonsense. And we have no recourse. We, the people, have no recourse.
And the sad part about it is, where do you find them? You find them predominantly in poor neighborhoods. They loan money to people who can't get credit anywhere else, who can pretty much least afford the high charges they pay. I mean, you talk about predatory, I think that's probably an understatement. If anybody needs protection, it's these people.
And, you know, at the end of it, you just got to shake your head and go, exactly whose side are, you know, people ask me, well, why are you a Democrat? Here's one of the reasons. I'm not a huge fan of Chris Dodd's. I think he did some pretty dumb things on the banking committee. I think taking the reins off of Wall Street was a pretty freaking stupid thing to do. Him and Barney Frank. It was pretty dumb. But at the end of the day, they said, well, we screwed this up. Now we got to fix it. And they tried to fix it. And the crazies on the right, oh, no, no, no. Wall Street's happy just where they are. They're thrilled driving the car, to use an Obama analogy. They're thrilled to be able to take you to the cleaner or to the fake courthouse. And then, I mean, think of the stones that it takes to build a fake courthouse and send out people in costume to scare people into. And now, look, at the end of this, and I'm not taking the side of the people who weren't paying their debts. Look, if you have a debt, you got to pay it back. I do. That's one of my core beliefs. But if you can't, you can't. If you're stuck in a situation where you're pretty well screwed, it is what it is. But to harass, intimidate, and this. We're going to take you to a fake courthouse and make you believe. We're going to arrest you and throw you in jail. What's next? Debtor prisons? If you listen to that guy who ran for governor in New York, yeah.
Pretty much. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. I shouldn't be surprised, but yet this kind of stuff does surprise me. I guess I still, even though politics makes you very, very cynical, I still have a basic trust of most people. But you look at something like this and it just, When does it stop?
That you can have a basic trust of people when for the last several years we've been talking about how people are constantly screwing each other.
No, I don't mean in a political process. I mean, I just have a basic, my philosophy has always been I trust you until you prove that you can't be trusted. I'm talking about me as a person and again, I shouldn't be surprised. I mean, when we think we've seen the ultimate, the Republicans take it to another level.
Well, I'm saying this is a wide range
of issues.
These are the capitalists. And I consider myself somewhat of a capitalist.
You can be a capitalist and still have scruples and morals and do the right thing. Oh, and how about this? Do what's best for the country? Now, there's a unique concept. Why don't we do what's best for the nation? That doesn't always enter into the pie, does it, Britton?
No, it actually doesn't. But, you know, you look at this, and it's amazing stuff, and it goes on every day. And I have a friend who's a CEO of a bank in the air, well, actually a credit union. And, you know, he said, you know, we don't agree, but we agree on consumer protection. And the analogy that he used is a good one. He said, you know, if somebody walks into a store and holds the store up, and the police catch him in the act, but the guy who's doing the charges, the guy who's writing up the reports, and the guy who's taking the statements and doing all of the documentation, if that guy does it wrong, he takes a shortcut and doesn't do what's right, what usually happens? Well, you go to court, and any lawyer worth his salt gets his client off. Why? Because the court and the court officers should be held to a higher standard. And I say the same thing about the banking industry. If you screwed up, if you made the mistake, you're the one out of it. Don't try and pawn it off on somebody else. You're held to the higher standard. And I look at this mock courtroom with mock security guards and go, these are the people we need to hold to a higher standard. This stuff cannot be tolerated. Cannot. And I'm going to give Corbett's office credit. They did the right thing here.
And what do you think will come out of it?
A small fine. And a promise I won't do it again. That's basically what, isn't that what always happens? A couple of bucks. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do it. And that's the end of it. Let's take a quick break. We're right back with the Reverend Peyton and his big damn band.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun & Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The 7 Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Can you hear me?
I'm doing fine. Can y'all hear me?
Yeah, I hear you great.
Good deal.
Levels all right?
Yeah, sounds good to me.
All righty. We're going to play a little clip of your music, come in, talk a little bit about the Reverend Peyton's Big Damn Band, about your album, The Wages, where you're going to be here locally, and maybe a little some things about what you've seen on the road.
All right, that sounds great.
All right, go ahead.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
Everything's raising but the wages. They say they're bailing out some fight. I'll take some of that money back. Too big to bail with my life work. I can't afford to pay to work. If I come there when I do, you know I'll be happy too. Everything's raising but the wages.
Well, that's true. Everything is raising but the wages. The more you look around, the more you're seeing people being thrown out of work, people losing their jobs, people seeing their pay cut. It just seems to be across the board. Not many working class bands out there, not many people bringing attention to this. That's why when I heard of Reverend Peyton's Big Damn Band, bigdamnband.com, I had to go and find their good reverend and bring him on the program. Reverend Peyton, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here with you. Thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Tell me a little bit about Reverend Peyton's Big Damn Band.
Well, we are a three-piece band from the hills of southern Indiana. And it's myself on guitar and vocals and sometimes harmonica, too. And my wife, Breezy, plays a washboard. And distant cousin, Aaron Cuz Persinger, is on the drums. And you know, we do 250 shows a year all over the world. We just got back from a month in Europe, and like just got back yesterday. And you know, so we're a band that travels a lot and sees a lot. And you know, I guess as far as songs go, you know, I write songs about, you know, things I see, things I like, things I don't like, my family, my friends. You know, I feel like as far as songwriting goes, there's a lot of people that are like, that are good fiction writers, you know. They tell great stories, but they're fiction stories, you know. Right. And I write nonfiction songs, you know. They're true. They're stuff that I've seen firsthand, or, you know, stories that come to me firsthand from my family and things. So that's you know, I think that's sort of as far as the style of music we play. I think that's I don't know. I think it almost has to be that way.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, there are not many bands out there that I would consider working class bands. I guess I should ask first, would you consider yourself a working class band?
Yeah, no, I think that's a pretty good description. You know, I mean, that we, you know, for generations of my family, working class people that, you know, we're sort of taught that you work hard and you play hard and you know, you put in an honest day's work and you are rewarded with, you know, with just enough to you know, keep your family fed and to you know, keep yourself safe. And you know, what we're seeing now is that you know, people that can't retire, they you know, you don't have the same health care benefits you used to have working for a big company. You know, used to a fellow that was uneducated could get a job with you know, a company like GM. And the deal was, if you put in your time and you worked there, you were guaranteed that your family and yourself were taken care of. You know, you gave them your life, but, right, you know, in return, you know, you at least got a certain amount of security for your family and yourself. And, you know, those are, you know, the pensions were replaced with 401ks that are, you know, being swallowed up by, you know, this economic turmoil. And, you know, not everybody has a finance degree. You know what I mean? Yep. So it's, in my opinion, you know, I think 401ks are great if you make, you know, six figures plus and, you know, you've had a couple of finance classes. But for a fellow that has not, that, you know, they don't work.
You know, that's one of the things we talk about here on the program, is that broken compact between working people and, you know, the boss, the investor class, the boss class. That broken compact where if you worked hard for your entire life, you made a profit for the owner of the company, that in your golden years, which, you know, may not be so golden, at least you don't have to eat cat food.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's pitiful because, You know, it's sort of like, and you know, I'm a person that as far as you know, I don't almost think that, you know, some people would say these is like, oh, you're talking progressive stuff, you're talking liberal stuff, but I almost think it's like conservative stuff. It's like old school American values. If a company gets too big, you bust it up.
Yep.
You know, that's what our granddads would have done. They wouldn't have let these companies get so big. These banks, you know, these banks held us hostage. They came to the governments of the Western world, Europe and the United States. We're just in Europe. They're in the same boat. And they said, listen, you have a choice. You can either bail us out, or we will go under, and we will take the entire world economy with us, and we're going to retire in the Bahamas either way, so you choose. So, you know, they held us hostage, and we had to do it. You know, we came, and we had to bail them out. And, you know, what should have happened, as soon as we'd done it, we should have went and just have said, okay, well, nothing's too big to fail, so we're going to just divide these banks up into about 20 banks. We'll create thousands of jobs that way. And then we have security from this ever happening again. But you know what happened? Not a whole hell of a lot.
Yep, they
got
bigger.
We're in the same boat. They could do it next year.
Yep, they actually got bigger. What I said right when it first happened, I said, we'll bail them out, but we nationalize them. We break them up into smaller state-run local banks, and we bring back state lines where you have state banking commissions who are in charge of their banks. But we didn't do that. We said, you know what?
We did nothing.
We gave them a
bunch of money.
Yeah, we just opened the checkbook, said, do what you got to do.
You know, to me, you know, I mean, I think it's almost like beyond what, you know, our politicians can even handle. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. We got a fella in Indiana by the name of Evan Bayh.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a Democrat. He's a fiscally conservative Democrat, I guess, what he likes to say. And his family's been, in politics here in Indiana for a long time. And there was an interview with him in Newsweek. And, you know, say what you will about Evan Bayh. He's got fans and, you know, friends and foes and whatever.
I was happy to say goodbye.
Yeah, well, a lot of people might, you know. But regardless of what you think about him, there's this interview with him in Newsweek. And he was talking about how he had come to the point where he felt like things were so broken in Washington he could no longer help. And he talks about how the, you know, 95% of the time of these people is spent just trying to solicit funds, you know, mainly from giant donors and corporations and even foreign entities. You know, they're on the phone with foreign entities trying to solicit money so they can, you know, put money into their campaign to get reelected. So that leaves, you know, of their time, 5% or less that they're actually spending any time doing any work for us or doing anything to try to help. And really, you know, I always say that if you owe money to somebody, they own a part of you.
Yep.
Like if you're paying more money to the bank, you don't own your house. The bank does. Your rent, you know, maybe in 30 or 40 years you might, but while you're making payments to them, they were the ones that really own your house. So if you are that, you know, sort of in debt to these people that are paying for your campaign, they're the ones that own you. You know, I mean, the system is really frightening. And I think that, you know, you see it. And you used to, you know, these, like people in Europe and around the world, they could say, oh, these are American corporations. Well, they're not really. You know, that's the kind of the fallacy of that. It ain't just American corporations. These are now multinational giant corporations. They don't care about America. They don't care about Germany. They don't care about Australia. They don't care about anything except for making money.
The bottom line, and you know, you go back to the Reagan years, Reagan and Thatcher. This was their vision. This neoliberal, one world, free trade, open borders for corporations. This is what we've gotten out of that.
Well, and you know, you're looking at it, and what you've seen. I like to paint this picture for people because to me, this is something I think is just very telling. Like you had these great American jobs, these great American blue-collar jobs working for companies like GM and whatnot. And these were jobs where an uneducated fellow could work hard and be taken care of. They were good jobs. Yep. People were proud to have them, and they were proud of them. And, you know, the products that were made were respected around the world. You still go to other countries, and if something's made in America, which hardly anything is anymore, but the stuff that is, people go, oh, man, it's made in America. That's good. Well, you know, these things that used to be made in America, they made it to where we could go, you know, a giant corporation could take their factories to countries that with no labor laws, no laws for the environment, none of these kind of regulations at all. And they can do stuff, you know, basically slave labor and, you know, run all the factories in America, you know, out. So then you've got, like, for instance, Mexico. You've got, you know, all these factories. You can see them. You drive, you know, through El Paso, and you can see what were American, you know, auto manufacturing factories on the other side of the border.
Yep.
You can see them. And, you know, but here's the thing that is the most telling to me. We still have so many people from Mexico trying to come here. They'd rather work here cleaning up, you know, our bathrooms, washing our dishes for less than minimum wage than to work at these jobs that were once great American jobs. And it's because the jobs are so much worse over there. They'd rather come here and essentially be, you know, under the table slave labor in a different kind. That is not good for us. It's not good for them. It's good for nobody. You know, what we should have said,
that's not
in
true.
My opinion,
that's
well,
not...
I guess it's good for a certain amount of people, I guess, but you know, when it comes down to it, it's not the world that I think that we want to live in. And you know what we should have done is we should have said, listen, China, you know your people are forced to do this and that. You don't have the same kind of rules for, you know, regulating the environment that we have, and et cetera, et cetera. So we're not going to do business with you until, you know, you can guarantee that children are not making our shoes and our iPods and everything else. But it didn't happen, so we're still buying stuff from them. You know, if you can ship an iPod 10,000 miles across an ocean and pay all that fuel and everything else, and it's still cheaper than what we can do here, something's wrong. There's something's out of balance. Something's out of whack.
Well, I think it goes back to...
Someone's getting screwed.
Right, I think it goes back to what you were saying about Evan Bayh, and the money that's so corrupt and so corrosive in our political system. This money, you know, bought these politicians who opened up these borders, made these free trade agreements with countries like China and India and all around the globe, where they have no environmental laws, they have no labor laws. There's none of that stuff. And we allow that stuff to be dumped here. And this year, I've been saying, is going to be the last year that this country will be the number one value-added producer. 110 years we held that title. And it wasn't taken from us. We gave it away.
Yeah, we gave it away. Isn't that sad? That's the sad part, you know. And, you know, people, there was this myth that, the Japanese cars are better, this or that are better. You know, you look around, you know, Americans had always been proud of what they made. And not saying other people are not, but Americans were proud of what they made, and they want to make things. People want to work here. You know, that's a falsehood. You say, well, Americans don't want to work. Americans don't want to do that stuff. Well, you know, as far as my family's concerned, the people I see, the people I grew up with, they want to work. They want their working conditions to be safe. They want their wage to be a living wage. But by God, they want to work, you know, and I think those things are what the whole world should need.
Absolutely.
You know, everybody deserves a living wage. Everyone deserves to have safe working conditions, and everybody deserves to be able to work and go to work and, you know, be proud of what they do. And regardless of what it is, whether it's sweeping floors or, you know, making cars or, you know, whatever it is you do, you know, it's sad. And I'm not an economist or anything. I'm not as far as that goes, I'm not a finance guy or nothing. You know, I'm a songwriter. I'm a singer of songs, and what I write about is just the stuff that I see. And I don't think you need to be an economist anymore to see that things are broken.
Nope. And I got to tell you, you're out there, Reverend Payton, preaching the word. I mean, that is something, what you've said here today is something people need to hear, and we're not hearing it in the mainstream.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot that's been taken from us in all that. You know, my great granddad was illiterate. He couldn't read. And he wrote this book with the help of a friend sounding out the words. And it was when he was dying, basically. And it's an autobiography that he, so when it says who did it, they wrote H-O-O. You know, it's hunted out, you know, it's just the turn of the century, you know, 1900 thereabouts to, you know, his life. My great granddad, I'm 29 years old. I ain't that old. And so it's not that far removed from myself, you know, a couple of generations. And, You know, the one thing in that book that is missing from our society, the one thread that is always in there, is a sense of community. We don't have that anymore. You know, we gave it away. We don't know our neighbors. We don't know where our food comes from. Used to, if you bought a steak and you sat down and you ate it with your family, you knew the farmer that grew it, the butcher that cut it, and the grocer that sold it to you. And all three of them guys, their good family name depended upon that piece of meat coming to you in good order. Now you go to Walmart and buy it, and all they care about is it's just good enough so you can't sue them. And they're always, every day, relaxing those rules for what's, you know, just beyond what they, you know, they can't sue you, or you can't sue them for. You know, I mean, it's sad, you know, and it's like a sickness, you know. And here's the scariest part about it, and this is why I think that, you know, I sort of say the stuff I say, is you've got people, whenever there is a hole in people's wallets, in their hearts, in their minds, in their community, whenever there's a hole, someone will be there to fill it, and it's usually the loudest guy. And, you know, we just have to be careful who we let be the loudest people are, because the forces of evil, darkness, whatever you want to say, they're always looking to fill that hole.
Yep.
And they'll fill it with fear. They'll fill it with whatever it takes, you know, and we have to stand up on the other side and say, no, you know, we have to fill it with truth, and we have to fill it with light and positiveness, whatever that is, you know. And like I say, I'm not a finance guy. I'm no economist. I don't have all the answers or any of them, really. You know, I just hope that, you know, when we sing songs and we go and we make music for people, and people have enjoyed it and they've entertained, and maybe they think about something, and I hope that maybe we reach somebody that does have the idea. You know, you get enough people talking about it, and I hope that somebody does have the idea. And it's going to take a lot of us, you know, together doing something. It's going to take more than just, you know, just simply talking about it. You know, it's for a lot of years, I think we sort of let the, we weren't minding the store.
Yep, and now it's going to take organizing. It's going to take people like the Reverend Peyton and his big damn band to get out there and spread the word. Where are you going to be? Where are you playing locally?
Well, we're going to be at the Appalachian Brewing Company, and that's tomorrow night, Thursday, the 11th. And it's actually a benefit. It's Music for Hope. It's a benefit for the American Cancer Society. So it's twofold. You know, times are tough, so you got to get a lot of value for your
yep.
for your money. So, you know, you're getting a show out of it, and we guarantee a great show. And you're also going to be, you know, supporting a good cause. So it's a lot of value there for your dollar.
And when does that start?
I believe the doors are 6:30, and we go on at 8:30. I believe there's a couple other bands, I believe, I think it's $10 in advance. So that's still a pretty good price.
It's a great price to go out and see some great music. Again, the Reverend Peyton's Big Damn Band, their website, bigdamnband.com. I got to tell you, Reverend Peyton, great talking to you. I hope you'll come back again.
Hey, have me back next time we're around. I appreciate talking with you. It's been great.
Would love to have you back. Reverend Peyton, thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Reverend Peyton's Big Damn Band, bigdamnband.com. We'll put a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. We're right back after this. Reverend Peyton.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for talking with me, man. It was great.
Yeah, I'm going to try and stop out tomorrow and say hello.
That'd be fantastic. Right. I look forward to meeting you.
Thanks so much. Have a great
Take
night,
care.
Man. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one? Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well. Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211. How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave? Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything?
That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5 or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Won't it be fun? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. The LA Times reports just about a year to the day that he left CNN, Lou Dobbs is returning to cable news, this time as host of his own show on News Corp's Fox Business Network. Fox Business Network is expected to announce that it has signed Lou Dobbs as early as Wednesday afternoon. It's the highest profile hire for the cable network, which launched a little over 3 years ago and has 57 million homes to its credit. That doesn't mean it has 57 million viewers. It means it's on the cable plans that 57 million people buy. I think I've probably got it. Can't find it on my dial, but I'm sure it is there. Although that is far fewer than he saw when he was on CNN, and it's far fewer than their chief rival CNBC. And that'd be interesting. Lou Dobbs going to bring his brand of hate back to the Fox airwaves. A perfect place for it, I think. Let's see how many ways we can make anti-immigration. You know, at one point I actually thought he was a sane guy. And then he just went off the deep end, because he was. He was talking the right message, I thought, for a while.
He was
talking about American jobs. He was talking about Buy American. He was talking
middle class, yes.
Yeah, I mean, he was there on I was sitting there going, yeah, you're right, Lou. Yep, right there, buddy. Keep preaching the, wait a minute. What's with that? Where'd that come from? But, you know, completely off the rocker.
And he started to blame those who were crossing the border for all kinds of problems, which for the most part were actually false charges, blaming the victims.
And what's funny is, you know, he evidently had hired a couple illegal immigrants himself.
Oh, say it ain't so.
To take care of his daughter's horse ranch down in Florida. He hired a couple people to take care of the horses. Kind of makes you wonder. And, you know, here my position has always been pretty simple on the immigration issue. I don't care who's doing the job. For me, it's about the job. I'm a working class guy. It's all about the job. I don't care who's doing the job. That job should pay a reasonable living wage with decent benefits, with decent health care. I don't care who's doing it. And that's all I care about. Now, the federal government should be doing its job, which it has abdicated for 30 years now, and enforce the laws we have. And that means, to me, go after these unscrupulous employers who bring these folks here, promise them jobs, pay them next to nothing, exploit them, and then when they get hurt, shove them out on the street.
And if you notice, those who oppose these people coming across the border, they always couch it as dollars and cents, like they're sucking up billions of your tax dollars. But here's one thing they don't explain. If that's true, and if you have all these millions of undocumented workers, and they give their employer an ID number, which is false, and they're taking money off of their check, which employers are supposed to, for all the deductions, Social Security, all workman's comp, all those people who are giving you false numbers are actually contributing contributing to that and getting nothing in return, yep. which to some degree at least counterbalances, but you never hear that argument. At the end of the day, a lot of these Republicans are phonies because they're not willing to go after the real culprit, which in many cases is these unscrupulous employers.
No, in every case, I don't buy this nonsense. Well, you know, we checked the papers. I don't buy that. And what the federal government has to do is they have to make it easier for people to check and to be diligent about it. And you know what? The people who do hire undocumented workers, penalties that are so draconian that it would basically put them out of business.
Well, what you need is to have penalties that, you know what, if we catch you, first time might be a big fine. Second time, you're going to jail. No ifs and ands about it. And I guarantee you, once you start putting people in jail, then people are going to start listening. Because if it's a fine, may or may not be enough incentive. I mean, look what happens in the workplace with OSHA. Yeah, there's fines, but these corporations basically absorb those fines. They don't do anything about unsafe working conditions. So it is with undocumented workers. Unless those fines are draconian enough and large enough, they're not going to change, but if you start sending them to jail, I guarantee you, you will cut down dramatically that problem. Guaranteed.
But, you know, at the end of the day, for me, it's about those jobs. And, you know, a study just came out that says, well, you know, the Mexicans are taking jobs that Americans would take if the wages were higher. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, given that premise, I can see that. If they were paying, you know, $20 an hour to pick lettuce, I guarantee you'd see Americans out there picking lettuce. They're not. They're paying $1.50, $2 an hour. You're not taking that job away. The people who clean hotel rooms who are making minimum wage are just above. There aren't a lot of people competing for those jobs in big cities. They're not. Every big city I go to, every person cleaning the hotel rooms are from somewhere around the world, maybe Mexico, maybe Guatemala, maybe Russia. You know, I used to go up into Portland, Maine, and up into Bangor, and all the people cleaning the hotel rooms were Russian women. Why? Because, you know, five or six of them would come over on student visas. They'd work here for 6 months, make enough money to go back and live for 6 months.
Oh, and then you have this ridiculous policy, and you kind of touched on it. I know there's some big corporations in this area that bring over students for the summer. Why? Because it can save some money, while at the same time denying locals those jobs. Wow. At the end of the day, it is about money, isn't it?
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, what do you think about this? You know, I look at this immigration problem, and look, the federal government has dropped the ball, as they have been doing for years. We did nothing during the Bush years. If the Republicans wanted to do something, they could have done it for 6 years, from 2001 into 2006. They could have easily done something, but they chose not to. They had other things on their mind. They had other priorities, as Cheney would say. Oh, I don't know, filling the coffers of their cronies? Yes. Having secret meetings on how they're going to divvy up Iraq? Yes. Having meetings with their buddies at Enron? Sure. You know, so I get these emails from folks, you know, who just completely off the wall, you know, talking about, you know, all the stuff that Obama's done. And when we, a little later on the program, maybe in the next segment, we'll talk a little bit about that.
Well, here again, Rick, there's one side of this story. We've covered it a couple of times, but it needs to be repeated. You know, the Democrats have done a lousy job saying, look, you know, one of the reasons for these hundreds of thousands of people coming across the border are the negative effects of NAFTA. We don't talk about it. How many times have you heard, other than people, spokespeople from the labor movement, a Democrat, really nailing the Republicans on that issue, which is a huge issue? Those people are coming across the border not because they see all these benefits in the United States. They do it out of desperation, out of literally to survive.
Well, the reason the Democrats aren't out there blowing the horn is there were a lot of Democrats who voted for it.
That's correct. That's correct.
You know, it may have been started under Reagan, hammered out under Bush Sr., and signed by Clinton. But there were still a lot of Democrats that got involved in that.
And who destroyed a lot of the Mexican small farms? An American corporation.
Of course they did. Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Federal mine officials want to shut down a Massey-owned Kentucky mine for thousands of safety violations. MHSA Administrator Joe Main says the Freedom Energy Mine has repeatedly shown it can't be trusted to follow basic safety rules, and if it's not shut down, someone may be seriously injured or die. Congress has yet to pass a bill improving mine safety. United Mine Workers of America President Cecil Roberts says if right-wing groups like the Tea Party continue to successfully harness some working-class anger at the polls, workers will suffer on a range of issues, including mine safety regulations, which Republicans continually try to block. Roberts says in this 75th anniversary year of the CIO, it's useful to remember where worker advancements over the years have come from.
It was a labor movement and a Democratic Party that gave us Social Security, that gave us Medicare, gave us a right to organize, gave us unemployment insurance, gave us a right to go on vacation, gave us a right to send our kids off to college like everyone else. It was a labor movement and a Democratic Party working in conjunction together that did those things. It was not the Republican Party and certainly was not some far-right organization like the Tea Party.
How many workers have become discouraged and given up hope? According to a new report in USA Today, that number is 1.2 million. 1.2 million unemployed workers have become so distraught in the inability to find a new job, they've removed themselves from the workforce altogether. According to employment data, there are only enough jobs available for one out of every five unemployed workers. Hyatt Hotel workers have filed the first of its kind multi-city injury complaint with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Jesse Russell reports.
The complaint covers 12 Hyatt properties in 8 cities. The filing was triggered in part by a study in the American Journal of Industrial Medicine that revealed Hyatt housekeepers as having the highest injury rate in the country. Allegedly, the chain has raised the room quota and in some cases doubled the industry standard for number of rooms to be cleaned. The complaint has recommendations for OSHA on ways to make the workload easier for housekeepers and reduce the risks of injury. Some recommendations include caps on daily room quotas, longer handles for mops, fitted sheets to reduce the number of times housekeepers must lift heavy mattresses, and others. The complaints were filed by workers in San Antonio, San Francisco, Chicago, Santa Clara, Los Angeles, Long Beach, Honolulu, and Indianapolis.
The National Labor Relations Board is accusing American Medical Response of illegally firing a union worker after she criticized her boss on Facebook. The Connecticut company fired Dawn Marie Souza in December of 2009. The National Labor Relations Act prohibits employers from punishing workers for discussing working conditions and unionization, and the NLRB says that includes postings on Facebook. Non-union as well as union workers have the right to discuss working conditions without being punished by employers. Souza did her Facebook posts while on her own time. A hearing on the case is set for January. This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Our friend Bob Kincaid over at the Head On Radio Network will be thrilled to hear the next story. Amanda Starbuck at the Understory writes, proud of their green wall, now PNC has a mountain top removal policy to be proud of too. I'm saying thank you. This is Amanda Starbuck saying thank you this week to PNC, which has just released its public positioning on mountaintop removal. Here is the excerpt from their policy paper. Mountaintop removal is the subject of increasing regulatory and legislative scrutiny with a focus on the permitting of mountaintop removal mines. While this extraction method is permitted, PNC will not provide funding to individual mountaintop removal projects, nor will PNC provide credit to coal producers whose primary extraction method is mountaintop removal. PNC is the seventh bank to issue such a policy: Bank of America, Citi, Morgan Stanley, Chase, JP Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Credit Suisse have all said no to mountaintop removal. I read that language and a little bit in there that makes me uneasy. But hey, a good start. Let's go to the phones. We got Don on line one. How are we doing today, Don? How are we doing today, Dan?
Dan, yes, hello. How you doing? This ain't Don, this is Dan.
How are we doing today?
Pretty good. How are you guys?
Oh, fantastic.
This immigration thing, you know, I think it's okay if you're here legally with papers and you can work, but if you're here illegally, you know, this is America, you know, home of the free, whatever, you know, but if you're here legally, great, you know, work, more power to you, love you, you know, we'll get along. You're here, if you have no papers, you're here working, you're a drag on our system.
Explain to me how you're a drag on the system.
Well, I mean, as far as the immigration, you know, they're wanting, you know, the health care, then we're getting into the health care thing, you know.
What health care thing? How many illegal immigrants go into the health care system? Because they're here illegally, remember?
Right. They're somehow, you know, they're getting into the system somehow. We don't know, you know. That's what I heard. I don't know. But they're...
But hold on, Dan, for a second.
Yes.
If you were in a country illegally and you knew that, you know, you were there illegally, would you willingly take yourself to Social Security, to welfare, to a hospital and present yourself as someone who's illegal?
Well, if you're hurt, you know, I mean, say, if I'm here illegally, I cut my arm off. What are they going to do, let you lay there? No, they're going to take you to the hospital, right?
Well, of course, so, and you would want any civil society to do that.
Right, and they're not going to pay for it, evidently, you know.
Well, so I know several people who are uninsured right now,
uh-huh.
who have been sick and have gone to the doctor, and they can't pay for it, so I'm missing your point.
Well, okay. He's going to be in the system. Say he cuts his arm off, he goes to the hospital, what's his name, what's his... Social Security number, you know what they ask you when you go into the hospital.
Right.
So what's he going to do?
It's a good question. Then what happens? Does INS...
Right. So that's... And he's not going to pay for it. You know what I'm saying?
But so's my buddy down the street who doesn't have a job. He hasn't had a job for several months, doesn't have health insurance. Same thing
right,
happened to him.
I mean, I'm sure he can prove he's a legal citizen.
Sure he can, but he's not going to pay for it because he doesn't have the money. He's broke.
Right. Right, that's where the health care thing comes in, you know. So what do you do?
See, for me, Dan, here's the thing. The immigration issue for me comes down to a couple simple things. One, every single job that someone who is here in an undocumented status takes should be a living job, living wage job with benefits and health care and pension and all of the things that we enjoy, or some of us enjoy. This way, employers don't have an incentive to undercut you or me or anybody else. We should be holding employers to a higher standard. You know, I talked to a guy who's considered an expert in immigration. He said that 80% of the people who come here in an undocumented fashion have a job before they leave their country because there are industries out there that bring folks exploitable labor into this country. So for me, before we start attacking the workers, we should go after the cause. And the cause are the people who run the business.
The employers.
Yep.
Right.
Because as a truck driver, Dan, when they open up the Mexican border and they say, open up the border, and those Mexican trucks come rolling through, and I know there are a couple. You know, I've been a truck driver for years. When that happens, they will be here in a legal status. That job is not going to pay a living wage, and it's going to hurt all of us.
Right, and they don't have to abide by our rules either, from what I heard.
Well, the border's still closed, fortunately, and I hope it never opens because it will destroy the industry in this country.
Right, you're right.
And it's, you know, it's something, you know, the Bush administration pushed for vehemently. They wanted that border open. And fortunately, we had, you know, a couple of Democrats who have spines. There aren't many of them, but a couple of them said no. And that's
well, that's, you know, the ones that want it open, that's more votes for them, you know, as far as what they see. That's what they look at, votes.
No, they look at money. You know? Money, Dan. It's about the big companies. It's about Swift and J.B. Hunt and all these big trucking firms who are going to make big, big money by putting new equipment down there and having drivers they can pay $10 or $15 a day. To drive all across this country and putting guys like you and me out of work.
That's right. That's right. Man.
So for me, again, to go, I'll go back to my original premise, Dan.
Yeah.
It's not about your status. It's about the job. It's about
the
making
job.
The job a living wage job with benefits and health care and pensions and a living job that you can support a family on. That's what it's for me. And that's what it should be for every person, whether
right.
they're documented or undocumented. Because right. once you stop that draw, once you stop the companies from bringing these folks in, then your problem ends. You know, it's like prostitution. If we stopped arresting the prostitutes and only arrested the guys who solicit the prostitutes, it'd go away because no guy wants his face on the front page of the newspaper.
You know, the hardest place to figure out where illegal is Houston, Texas.
Yeah.
Anywhere
that's
really
Texas.
Hard. Yes. It's like being in Mexico when you're in Texas. So, you know, it's really hard. But like I said, if you're here legally, fine. If you're not, vamos, you know, go south, go back south.
But here again, it's not that simple. If you
right.
go back, if you go back and you look at NAFTA, Dan, when we passed NAFTA, one of the things that Mexico had to do is they had to change their constitution in order to become part of this trade agreement. And in their constitution, it used to say that every community had X amount of land to feed their people. So in order to sign NAFTA, they had to strip land away from their communities that fed their communities, had to strip it away. So that when they opened the borders and big American agriculture came in and destroyed all of these farming communities, leaving these people with nothing, where do you think they went? They went north to the maquiladoras where all the U.S. businesses set up shop. And when they couldn't
right.
get jobs there, they kept going north where jobs were. And we had employers who were saying, yeah, come, we'll hire you for less than minimum wage. We can undercut U.S. labor. Don't focus on the people, Dan. Don't focus on the worker. Focus on the employer. They're the scoundrel in this, not the guy
right.
who's trying to feed his family.
They wouldn't know, you know, they wouldn't hire, you know. So
Where are you from, Dan?
St. Louis.
Where? St. Louis?
St. Louis, yes.
Yeah, because I've made arguments to some of my southern friends who are truck drivers that up here in the northern area, technically you can be considered almost a Mexican here because you're willing to work for less than I'm willing to work for here. So it's not about the people. Stop with the people. It's about the job.
Right.
I appreciate the call, Dan. Thank you.
All right, Dan. See you.
And for me, that's what it's always been. It's about the people. Make the job what it is. It's got to pay a reasonable wage. It's got to pay benefits. It's got to be a safe job. Focus on that. Don't beat up on the folks. Don't beat up on the people. Because you know what? In that situation, if I found my family, my wife and my three kids, if we lived south of the border and I looked into my kids' eyes and I saw that they were hungry, you bet your bottom dollar I would be here as fast as you could possibly imagine and as often as I could get here in order to feed those children. And that's what that's about for them. Look, there's a draw. They know that they can feed their kids. They know that they can take care of their families by coming here and taking some crappy jobs, cleaning toilets and cleaning hotel rooms, picking lettuce and on the, you know, not easy work.
And that's one thing that we don't seem to want to challenge head on. The conditions in Mexico are just so bad that they're forcing these people to, out of sheer desperation. And we have to address that somewhere along the line. Am I wrong, Rick? Our politicians don't seem to want to address that issue. Don't seem to want to touch it.
Look, at the end of it, they don't want to tick off the Latino community by appearing, and the Republicans have done that. This anti-immigration stance that they've taken has really ticked off the Latino community, although we can't tell from this last election. So the Democrats tiptoed around it. Look, you've got to be firm. We need to secure our borders. We need to know who's coming into the country. We need labor. We need low-skilled labor. Honestly and truthfully, look at the demographics. As your generation, Jake, gets older, and mine as well, as we move into our golden years, you're going to need more people to wipe our noses. So you're going to need that unskilled to moderately skilled labor. That's why you need folks coming in, but you need to know how they're coming in. So however you secure the border, you got to do that, and you've got to make it a path for people to come in. Simple stuff.
No, once again, I do believe the Democrats haven't been out in front on saying, hey, look, as a party, And yes, there were some Democrats that supported NAFTA. But in general, the Democratic Party opposed it. They need to say to the American people, we need to look at the impact, the negative impact, huge negative impact in countries like Mexico, and understand that that's a main reason why these people are coming across. And the truth is, and you hit it, this isn't about whether you're Mexican or American. This is about people who have families who are desperately hurting, and you will do what you have to do. And if that means coming across the border, you will do that. And that's not going to change, especially if we don't address the economic issues in Mexico. We have to long-term, whether we like it or not.
Now, I do believe there is a drug war going on our border, and we've got to do something about that. And that's got to be in conjunction with the Mexican government. They've got to step up and take the reins. Simple stuff. But the problem is you've got so much money controlling these cartels. It's something we got to take care of. Let's take a quick break. Come back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You think you need an attorney? You probably don't. To protect yourself, you do need to know your rights. Retain control. Order your free book, The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Order your free book, The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com or calling 695-4722.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. Right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are. Not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Right now, like we talked about in the last segment, PNC not going to be funding any more mountaintop removal, which I think is a good thing. It's something that needs to be stopped. You know, and I've said this before, our good friend over at the Head On Radio Network, Bob Kincaid, gave me this book, The Plundering of Appalachia. And you look at these pictures of just blown off mountaintops, where they had just completely leveled for as far as the eye can see. What were once beautiful mountain ranges, all for a very small amount of coal. The reason they do it, it's profitable. It's not labor intensive. You know, you blow a bunch of stuff up, scrape what you need off, put it in the truck, ship it off to China, and take all of that waste and push it right into the water or into big sludge pits that are going to be trouble down the road. But, you know, we gotta pander to big business. We gotta worry about the business people. Which brings me to our next story. AP reports a tiny desert town whose plight was made famous by the movie Aaron Brockovich, has seen a dramatic increase in the size of a toxic plume of chromium as it spread to multiple groundwater sources. Water regulators earlier this year discovered a well with increasing concentrations of the cancer-causing pollutant, and now even more wells have been uncovered with elevated levels of chromium, according to Lori Kemper, Assistant Executive Officer of the Lathom Regional Water Control Board. The Water Board on Monday ordered Pacific Gas and Electric to do additional groundwater monitoring at the site near Hinckley, about 120 miles northeast of Los Angeles. Kemper told the Associated Press on Tuesday the more dispersed chromium continues to move. Because of the widespread nature of the lower concentration chromium, it's difficult to capture the contamination. Get this. The contamination was first publicized during a 1996 court case, in which PGE settled with the 600 Hinckley residents for $330 million. Not an awful lot of money. Many sick residents blamed the contaminated water for their crippling health problems that include Hodgkin's disease and breast cancer. You'll remember from the movie, the Aaron Brockovich movie, she was a legal assistant who uncovered that, PGE knew. They knew what they did. They polluted the city's water supply, and they did nothing about it. While tests now show the plume was spreading again in 2008, and PGE took some action that it thought would contain the contamination, tests in March showed that it was growing again and is now more than 2 miles long and a mile wide. Current chromium levels near Hinckley remain low enough not to violate current drinking water standards, but some studies have shown that long-term exposure to even low levels of the compound can contribute to health problems. Now, you throw this together. You throw this together with why November 2nd was so important. The very people who won on November 2nd are the same people who would say no regulations. We don't need oversight of PGE. They're doing what they're supposed to do. They're making profit, and they're providing a service. They're hiring workers. Even if they're killing their workers and the community around them, that's how business is done. And if you're harmed, you take them to court. And you look at this, Jake, and you go, okay, 1996 you did this. You got sued for $333 million, 600 people, not a lot of money, to be honest. What did it stop? Nothing. Here we are, 14 years later. No different. And as I've said a number of times, we're going to be fighting wars over water, which is why I found Scott Phil's piece over at Alternet interesting. He writes, billions have been spent allowing corporations to profit from public water sources, even though water privatization has been an epic failure in Latin America, Southeast Asia, North America, Africa, and elsewhere where it has been tried. But don't tell that to controversial loan sharks at the World Bank. Last month, its private sector funding arm, the International Finance Corporation, quietly dropped a cool 100 million euros, about $139 million, on Viola Vode, an Eastern European subsidiary of Viola, the world's largest private water corporation. Its latest target, privatization of Eastern Europe's water resources. So we're seeing corporations sucking all of this water up. And as we saw in Bolivia, when Bechtel went in and bought up the water supply in Bolivia, you couldn't even put a bucket out. You couldn't even put a cup out in the rain without them coming and suing you, because that's their water, they said.
Question. How long do you think it'll be before we really have huge water wars? I mean, I know there's skirmishes already. I think we're talking with Georgia and Florida, out in the southwest. We've already had skirmishes, but when is that going to, shall we say, degenerate into full-scale war?
I don't know that it's going to happen here anytime in our lifetime. I think it's already happening in Africa and in some of the, some of Ethiopia and Darfur and some of those other countries where, potable water is such a precious resource. It's like anything, it's like oil, it's like gold. If it's in scarce supply, you're going to have people killing each other.
There's only so much water.
And these private corporations, they understand that. And they're buying up this private resource, which is why I've always said that that should be something that's held by the people. It should be part of the commons, the water structure. Here in this area, I know American Water Company is owned by a French company, which you figure that out because I can't. How American Water is owned by a foreign corporation, but it is. And you look at a lot of the privatized systems in this country, they're owned by either the Thames in England or, the one in, what's the one in France? Oh, come on. I always forget that. Or a Spanish company that owns up a bunch of water. And once it comes down, it's the new oil. Because unlike oil, we can't live without water. I think we could get by without oil. It would be difficult. But without water, you're done.
There is no alternate fuel to water.
Your body needs it. What are you? What, 70% water?
Yes, pretty much.
Without something to drink, it's game over. You can last, 3 days, I think they've said, without water?
You can last much longer without food than you can water.
I could last a whole lot longer without food.
Yeah, some of us more so than others, right? Right.
Yeah. Well, after this weekend, we had a great weekend, and the food was excellent, especially since we didn't have to cook, and there were no kids. Had a wonderful weekend. In fact, we spent our whole time in the water because our room had a swimming pool right in the room. You stop and you look around the globe. And that there are people struggling all around the world. And you look at this hotel we stayed in. Had a hot tub. It had a swimming pool all in your room. You got to love that.
Nice.
And you wonder why the rest of the world hates us.
Can you say pampered?
Yeah, we were. But, again, this water thing. Trouble. If we continue to back the IMF and the World Bank and their push towards privatization. And it's on many levels. I mean, when you're talking about globalization, which we've been pushing for 30 years, ever since Reagan and Thatcher and the neoliberal trade agenda, this idea that, the world would be on one plane, or as Friedman called it, the great leveling off, where everybody's working for about $6 an hour and you have a global wealth class. Which you start looking around and you go, not too far off.
Boy, you had a prick that sore point. I can remember way, way back when this NAFTA issue came up. And I can remember saying to myself, well, now, wait a minute. Now, you're promising us that eventually countries like Mexico, because of these free trade agreements and this magical panacea, that their economy is going to improve and improve and improve and improve to the point where they can actually buy what we make. How many years are we talking here?
In the long run, yes.
What, 50 years from now?
But I think as Ricardo said, in the long run, we're all dead.
How did we make out? Let's see, 16 years? What's the scoreboard?
Well, I mean, if you listen to what...
Not very good. What
Reverend Payton had to say. And I thought he was excellent. And some of the points that he made were spot on. We had good paying jobs for uneducated people, people who could work with their hands. And we valued hand work and we valued craftsmen and we valued people who knew how to do things. Now, I'm not so sure about that.
We used to call them vo-tech, and there's nothing wrong with that. People who would go to school, maybe earn a trade, learn to become a carpenter, learn to become a mechanic.
A truck driver.
In high school, we didn't have those schools, but those schools were certainly available. Where are those people now who are simply vo-tech, who have no aspirations of going to college? That doesn't mean they're dumb. That just means they prefer that.
Well, here's the thing. I went to college.
Where are those jobs for those people?
Driving a truck.
Now the closest you'll get is maybe fixing a coffee machine at McDonald's, if you can call that being a mechanic.
Well, when I was watching, I think it was Fox News the other day, and they were talking about the manufacturing jobs that are coming back, and they showed someone on a McDonald's assembly line. They're putting hamburgers together. That's the new manufacturing job, putting a hamburger on a bun. That's the manufacturing job of the future. And, you know, here's the thing. Here's the problem with this country in a nutshell. You know, when I got out of college, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do, didn't know where to go. I end up working for a freight company, throwing boxes on a dock. One day a guy goes, hey, can you drive a truck? Oh, yeah, sure, I can drive a truck. I got out there, grind the gears up, and after a couple days, I figured it out.
And a million miles later, a perfect record later, here you are.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well,
Who would have thunk it?
Well, I would have. But, you know, at the end of it, you got to teach people a skill. And they've got to learn. And we should be providing that training. Unfortunately, the trucking industry really has taken a nosedive because we're going to start competing with Mexico and just the nature of the beast.
And isn't it ironic that these conservatives, you talk about less government. Less government, the Republican Party, less government, less regulation. We had that argument. They can't say they didn't know. One of the most cogent arguments that the other side, the opposing, those who oppose NAFTA said, we are giving up our sovereignty.
Yep.
We are giving up our sovereignty in this nation.
And look where we are.
And look where we are.
Let's take a quick break. We're back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Our society, like most others, glorifies war. For God and country is the cry. Be all you can be is the manly challenge. Bring 'em on was George W.'s machismo war whoop, which drew cheers from barstool soldiers like he had been. Of course, war must be glorified to make it possible. How else can presidents and generals lure sane young men and women into the voracious maw of deathly chaos and unimaginable horror? As General William T. Sherman put it in 1880, young men think that war is all glamour and glory, but let me tell you, boys, it is all hell. For a glimpse of this hell, check out an October 30th Washington Post article titled Operation Damage Control at WashingtonPost.com. It's meant to be a positive piece, extolling the wondrous ability of U.S. trauma teams in Afghanistan to save grievously injured soldiers. But the article also lifts the covers on the raw carnage that is the true story of war, highlighting 9 soldiers injured in a single week. 2 of them lost a leg. 2 others lost a leg and a foot. 2 lost both legs. 2 lost both legs and a hand. 1 was paralyzed from the waist down. 3 also lost their genitals. Lost is a euphemism for blown apart. But as the Post points out, bombs not only shred limbs, quote, they drive dirt deep into flesh and often peel skin back a foot or more above the bone's jagged end. It takes multiple surgeries over several weeks just to find all the damage. Blood clots, pneumonia, collapsed lungs, and other complications often follow, all deadly. Not to mention the brain damage, pain, and psychological trauma. This is Jim Hightower saying, so far some 8,000 soldiers have been injured in Afghanistan. And for what? Ask them about the glory of war.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, you know, if the folks on the Cat Food Commission have their way, they're going to smash up Social Security. I'll tell you that right now. They've come out with a preliminary report. It's, oh, such nice language. So patriotic. Oh, but still my heart. Let me read a little bit of it to you, so you get a kind of a feel of where the cat food commission is going to be going here. Their guiding principles. Number one, we have a patriotic duty to come together on a plan that will make America better off tomorrow than it is today. American cannot be great if we go broke. Our economy will not grow, and our country will not be able to compete without a plan to get this crushing debt burden off of our back. Throughout our history, Americans have always been willing to sacrifice to make our nation stronger over the long haul. That's the promise of America. That's the promise of America, to give to our children and our grandchildren, to give them a better life. American families have spent the past 2 years making tough choices in their own lives. They expect us to do the same. The American people are counting on us to put politics aside, pull together, not pull apart, and agree on a plan to live within our means and make America strong for the long haul. And there's that line I love, within our means. And I guess the way we're going to do that is we're going to balance budgets on the backs of the poor, the children, and the elderly. Because there isn't anything in this plan that says we're going to ask the very wealthy to contribute a little bit more. We're not going to ask those who can afford to contribute a little bit more. What there is a raise in the age of Social Security, a cut for some folks in Social Security, and a cut in programs that are going to, help people at a time when we're going to, cut taxes on corporations. Does that make a lot of sense to you? Doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me. They need to, number nine is reform and simplify the tax code. And what does that mean? Broad base, lower rates, they say, to bring down the deficit. Well, broaden the base means, since 47% of the population doesn't pay any taxes, we need the poor people to start paying. Even though their wages haven't kept up with inflation, even though their wages have been stagnant for almost 30 years, now they have to pay. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. There are a lot of common sense things we could be doing to bring our budget deficits down. There are a lot of common sense things that we could be doing to make sure that Social Security is solvent for generations to come. But we're not talking about that. And you look at the people who are on this cat food commission, Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, never fans of Social Security. You'll remember our buddy Alan Simpson with his comment that, well, America's a cow and it's got 310 million teats and all the people are sucking off of it. Did you ever think, Alan, that Social Security is something that we paid into? It was a promise that we made to our seniors. It's a promise that we made to ourselves. Look, I could easily fix our problem with Social Security. The problem is we don't have the political will to do it because it would upset the wealth class. And I'm not talking about soaking the rich, which anytime you start talking about asking people who have the means to contribute, anytime you ask them for help, that's somehow soaking the rich. It's not soaking the rich. It's saying, hey, you're the one who uses the majority of the infrastructure that our tax dollars created. I don't know. Maybe help kick in a couple of bucks. Is that too much to ask? Is that too much to ask? I don't think so. And as Bernie Sanders said, he called this commission's proposal reprehensible, extremely disappointing, and something that should be vigorously opposed by the American people. And I agree. Rich Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO, said the chairman of the deficit commission just told working Americans to drop dead. Some people are saying this plan is just a starting point. Let me be clear, it is not. It's not a starting point. And what this is, understand, right now this probably isn't gonna pass. What this is it's planting that seed, Jake. Planting that seed in the younger generation's mind that it's not gonna be there for me. And like any good employer knows, it's about divide and conquer. It's about tearing the classes apart, tearing the genders apart, tearing the ages apart. Because if you can separate them, you can beat them. The old divide and conquer. And this nation has never been more divided than it is right now. We are sliced and diced in the working class. You got people who are white collar, blue collar, pink collar, green collar, union, non-union, white, black, Hispanic, you name it, they've divided us into categories. And like I said at the beginning of the program, we're not talking to each other. We're not having conversations. We're not organizing. We're not coming together. And they've got us right where they want us. You want to know what's wrong with Social Security? What's wrong with Social Security is you only pay Social Security tax on $106,800 of wages. Wages. Wages only. Not interest, not, you know, not when a Wall Street executive makes huge bonuses, not when a Wall Street trader makes $4 billion. None of that. No. Only on a guy swinging a hammer or punching a clock. Now think about this. Let's say you make $100,000 a year. You're a hardworking guy. You're putting in extra overtime. You know, you're driving that truck 70 hours a week, 52 weeks a year. Never take a day off. Never miss a trip. You make $100,000 a year because you've been running stones to the wall. You pay tax, Social Security tax, on 100% of your income. Every penny of it. Now, the guy who owns the company, let's say he takes himself a $500,000 a year salary to sit behind the desk and tell you where to go. You know how much he pays in Social Security tax as a percentage? 21%. 21% of his income is Social Security tax. Tell me what's fair about that. And as I've said a number of times, what we need to do, we need to lower that 12.6% number. We need to lower that. Something reasonable. On every dime of income, not wages, income. And I'm saying about 4%. 4% on every penny of income. That would be a better way to go. It'd be a simpler way.
Certainly would stimulate the economy, wouldn't it? Be a de facto stimulus plan. Absolutely.
And you'd get money into the pockets of people who, need the money. Workers who spend their money. But, you know, we won't have that discussion. What we're going to talk about, and this is what the Republicans are going to push down our throats, especially if they win in 2000, the White House in 2012. Private accounts, individual accounts, you know, so you can have your own 401k into Social Security. Retirement ages of 69, 70. And they're going to help destroy Medicare. Because they've always been against it. It's something they've always fought against.
What I don't understand, they're talking about a debt commission. Yet what they're talking about here, and you may or may not have covered it, they want to reduce the corporate tax rates and reduce the tax rates on the wealthy. How is that reducing the deficit?
Well, that was their grand idea. We're going to raise, I said it earlier, they're going to raise taxes on the broad base, which are the 47% of the people who pay nothing because they make nothing. They're going to do like Reagan did in 86, raise the bottom tax rate and lower the top rate. And they're going to cut off corporate taxes. You know, because we need America to be the best place to start a business.
We've seen this play before. This is warmed over Reaganomics. It doesn't work.
It's never going to work, but we seem to be so dense that they can keep throwing the same failed ideology, the same stupid ideas at us, repackage it, put a little lipstick on some bubble-headed bimbo who's going to come out and say, oh, yeah, I love this, and we're going to buy it because all the blood rushed out of our ever-loving skulls. And we buy it because, oh, she's cute to look at. Her. Oh, look, she's one of us. Oh, boy. Look, Ma, she's stupid like me. When are we going to wake up? I mean, could Sarah Palin really be our next president? Please tell me no. Please tell me I'm not living a nightmare. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. We're right back after this.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
On December 28, 1970, President Richard Nixon signed the Occupational Safety and Health Act into law. Thanks to strong lobbying efforts by union leaders over many years, this safety bill of rights established for the first time a comprehensive national policy to protect workers' health and safety. Effective April 28, 1971, employers were required to provide a workplace free of known hazards that caused or were likely to cause serious physical injury or death. Prior to the passage of OSHA, work-related injuries and deaths were extremely high. The 1920s saw reports of 20,000 workers killed on the job and more than 2.5 million injured per year. That number remained until the 1960s when work-related deaths dropped to 14,000 per year, but injuries increased by 20%. Today, thanks to OSHA, protections on the job injuries have fallen 40% and on the job deaths have been reduced by 60% pre-OSHA. OSHA is considered the first piece of legislation allowing the government to inspect and hold employers accountable for dangerous and physically harmful working conditions. OSHA has three branches: an enforcement branch, a research branch, and a review branch. Since its passage, OSHA has allowed for greater visibility and oversight in conditions on the job, prioritizing efforts to prevent accidents, control health hazards, and ensure workers go home as safe and as healthy as when they arrived on the job. While OSHA is a step in the right direction, there is still considerable work to be done, and only through the eyes and voices of working people with the help of their unions will tomorrow be a safer day. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therichsmithshow.com.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show. You can't tell.
We better get ready for the revolution. We better be preparing. We better be standing together, begin that organizing process. I got a press release today from State Representative Rick Marabito. He announced that he was happy that the House Democratic leadership listened to his call and to the call of other Democratic members and agreed to hold a voting session on Monday to address the unfinished business before the legislative session ends November 30th. And he pointed out a couple of the things that are pretty important, like House Bill 2497, to look at the pension system and some of the things that they need to be working on. Also, House Bill 1231 for the firefighters to take a look at, you know, some of the occupational disease qualifications for some folks who suffer from cancer. And there are a bunch of other stuff, some food safety laws, another one that deals with encouraging farmers and food processors to donate excessive food to food banks, which I think is a great thing. Another one would ensure both parents are treated equally when deciding child custody. As a male, that's a big one to me because very few men get custody of their children. Another one that looks at clean and green programs to help save some of the open space. Another one that would create an affordable housing trust fund. That's smart policy. Also the creation of electronic waste recycling programs. All good stuff that need to be voted on. I don't think can wait. They're supposed to do their jobs. They've got another couple of days. They should be punching the clock like the rest of us.
Absolutely.
Well, go ahead. Knock yourself out. What do you got?
Okay. After the election, the local newspaper, the Patriot News, which I think is a good idea, went out in the community, kind of get a feel for the reaction of citizens at large, and he went into one of the local diners. And what caught my eye was the comment by an individual by the name of Harold Lepley of New Cumberland. And I'm sure his opinions follow the opinions of a lot of people in this area. This is what he said. It's government that's the disease. Cuts are the cure. The government feeds on the people. It's like a cancer. At the same time, he wouldn't touch Social Security. We pay for that. It comes out of your pay. You have no choice. He also adds that he's also earned Veterans Administration benefits and his Medicare coverage and wouldn't want to see either of them reduced. Now, here's the problem. First of all, he apparently doesn't quite understand that Medicare, Social Security, and, by the way, the health care, which he gets out of, I'm sure, like a lot of people, they take Medicare and they also go to the Veterans Administration for certain things. They're all government programs. Medicare, or the Veterans Administration has TRICARE, which is a quintessential single payer. If you take the defense budget, which is part of the Veterans Administration, you take Medicare, Social Security, and the interest on the deficit, you're talking about 70% of the budget, which I don't think the average person understands. So where do you cut? You talk about a huge disconnect. And this gentleman, on the one hand, wants to castigate government, wants to cut it wherever possible, but yet in his own life, if it wasn't for government, I doubt very much whether he would be in the positive situation he is. And that's pretty emblematic of a lot of Americans.
Well, in bringing that up, and I think people need to understand that. That, you know, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the interest on the national debt, not to mention Iraq, and all of the defense stuff that we spend on, mm-hmm. That's the vast majority of our budgets.
70%.
You know, someone had, I talked about a thing over the weekend about, you know, someone had said, well, what Congress should do is they should cut their salaries of all the congressional people. And the reality is for someone making the median income in this country, which is a little over $34,000, for all the salaries and all the benefits of all the members of Congress, it only costs us 19 cents apiece to pay for that. We're not talking huge, massive payments. Now, you're talking about Social Security. If you made just over $34,000, you're looking at over $1,000 for Social Security. You're looking at well over $625 for Medicare, almost $400 for Medicaid, almost $300 for the national debt. Yet all the Republicans have kept talking about are minor little small cuts. And you can go to their website, youcut.com, and you can see some of the dumb things that they've said, oh, we need to cut this. You know what it is? It's all stuff that benefits us. Education, nutrition, you name it. Anything that benefits the workers or the poor, screw them people. We're cutting them off at the knees. Anything that benefits corporations, oh, by all means, take more. Here, take from this poor child. It's for you because you give us jobs.
But the best one is all that tax money that's being given to unions. I'd certainly like to know exactly. I'd like to know a little bit more about the specifics on that one. Don't you just love that one? What is he talking about? What is he talking about?
Complete nutcase.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, it's this belief that corporations, out of the goodness of their heart, they give us jobs, and we should be thankful. We should bow to the Almighty, the benevolent corporation. And the reality is it's not like that at all. The reality is the guy hired you because he's going to make a profit off your back. If he couldn't make money off you, you wouldn't be there. And you understand that. I'm going to go work for you. I'm going to make you money. And in turn, I'm going to get some of it for my time. I'm going to help support my family. But I want a fair shake. I want a fair share of it. And to me, that's where collective bargaining comes in. You know, if capital can commingle and they can come together and form a corporation, why can't workers take their time and gather together and collectively bargain like capital does and form sort of a corporation or a union? You're kidding. Oh, no, can't talk about that.
I guess not. A couple odds and ends here, Rick. I don't know if you heard the latest coming out of Alaska. Joe Miller has gone to federal court And he wants the federal court to issue an edict which
demands
that. Now listen to this, which demands that any write-in vote has to be exactly right. Has to be exactly right, or it's counted as a no. So now he wants the election commission to be a walking dictionary. I hope he loses. I hope for the democracy he loses. By all accounts, she's going to win unless he pulls out something like this.
Well, if they come up with that, I said from the beginning I thought that it had to be right. But I have read since that voter intent is what they take. So if someone were close, that's probably going to go. And if someone just put an X, or a check or whatever in the write-in category, that's not going to count.
So she has 9 letters in her name, and 8 of them are right. And the intent is obviously there. You know, not everybody is.
You err on the side of the voter.
That's right. That's right. You err on the side of the voter. But
and look, at the
I
end
think
of
that's
this,
the only chance he has.
At the end of this, we're not getting anything out of her.
Joe Miller
should be less crazy than he is.
Look, someone that has the nerve, the kahunas, to say that we shouldn't have a national minimum wage. I mean, cut me a break.
Well, we shouldn't have unemployment, even though my wife took it. We shouldn't have state Medicaid programs, even though I had to use it. I love the hypocrisy.
Oh, but the Alderman one, and you talked about it numerous times. They want to run for office. Now, think about this. They want to run as a representative of their state in the U.S. Senate. And they're going there to destroy the very system that they say they want to serve. I'm going there to destroy government. And he's proud of it.
Yep.
I mean, wow. Are these, are these people Daniel Boone? Did they just come out of the forest?
And what's even scarier? Are there people
with
who
their musket?
They're even scarier, there are people who vote for him with that intent. I want to see him tear down government because I want this to be a good old-fashioned American corporatocracy.
But I lack my check from the government because of all that oil up here.
Yeah, that's another
I'm sounding like you. Now, that's scary. One other thing I found interesting, the Republicans are spinning that this is a repudiation of the Democrats and Obama. Well, here's an interesting fact. A lot of the Blue Dogs lost. Now, part of me says hooray, part of me says, well, I'm not sure how that dynamic's going to work. But there was actually only one conservative Democrat that survived that voted, one, against health care reform, and two, against unemployment extensions. Do you know what his name is?
Yeah, probably Tim Holden.
No. Heath Shuler. Does that name sound familiar?
He was a quarterback.
That's correct. You know who he played for.
Could care less.
Okay.
North Carolina.
Washington Redskins. And before that, he played for the University of Tennessee, who, by the way, I know you don't care, but I have to say this, being who I am, they played in a bowl game in the 90s against Penn State, and I remember Heath Shuler. And by the way, we kind of ran all over Tennessee that year, but he is the only one who survived. I mean, I think that's telling.
Well, I guess the telling part of it is, look, in 2008, 2006 and 2008, a lot of Democrats picked up seats that historically had been Republican seats. And what you saw is you saw some conservative Democrats win in those areas because they held the same conservative values as the Republicans, only the voters wanted the Republicans out. So now a lot of those seats just went back to where they had historically been. What's scary to me is with the reapportionment, it's going to get even worse.
Yes. And as I had a report here, I don't want to go into all the depth, it would take too long. But, there's 4 states that the Republicans have totally taken over. It's you talk about vote-rich states for the 2012 election. Talk about Texas, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Ohio. Those are 4 of the 10 biggest states in the country. And they have complete control.
Yeah, well, here's the
reapportionment. The whole political process leading to 2012. Right. To me, that's an alarm.
Yeah, but here's the thing. If the economy doesn't turn around in 6 months to a year, you're going to see them lose. And if it doesn't turn around in 2 years, kiss them goodbye.
Well, the American people, for 3 straight elections, it's been a sea change at ping pong.
Yep.
And it could be the Republicans' turn to get bombed again.
Yep. We'll see you tomorrow night.
Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming up like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious.
skin, amber spray. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.